Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the tremendous 12th episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the irredeemable Shag, and along with me is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
Howdy, Shag. Do you realize that, this is our first recording together of 2026, which means you and I have been podcasting together for 15 years.
Oh, my gosh. We started Who's Who in 2012. So I was thinking about just because someone made a comment. We'll get to in a bit about how we still kind of say the same things we said the first time around. But, yeah, I mean, we said those things 14 years ago. So I don't remember what I said this morning. So that it's perfectly fine that we're revisiting and having maybe some of the same thoughts.
I mean, you are hopped up on cold medicine right now, so your memory is even more sketchy than normal.
That is absolutely true. You know, I think you can chart my illnesses by the Who's Who podcast because they always seem to hit when we're doing a Who's Who. I remember we did one episode where I could barely even talk.
Mm-hmm.
That was my favorite episode. I'm sure it was. I've got the Phoebe Buffay sexy voice going on right now. It hasn't gone all squeaky yet, so that's something.
Do you?
I do. Yes, I do. On that happy note, let's remind the folks why we're here. We are here to talk about Who's Who, the definitive directory of the DC Universe, our beloved 26-issue series that we love so very much, and what we've been doing here after we finished the whole run and all the loose leaf and all of that, except for the Impact. We have decided to go back into the original Who's Who series and randomly pick 13 characters from that first volume of Who's Who and talk about them. And so far, do you realize as of this episode, we're about 20% done going through all the characters again? I did the math on that. Isn't that crazy?
Wow. Time flies. Exactly. Yeah, we love the Who's Who comics and this show, and we wanted to find a way to continue the podcast into infinity. And this gives us a chance to talk about our favorite volume of Who's Who in a hopefully fresh new way.
And just so you know at home, I did count. There is 819 entries. So I had to take off my shoes and everything to count for that. And you know how much I like taking my shoes off. So on that note, on that incredibly smooth segue, why don't we thank our sponsors? Folks, this episode of the Who's Who podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. What you got, buddy?
I brought Peacemaker Presents, which is just funny. I like the idea that he's like, you know, he's like a host now, insane Peacemaker. Peacemaker Presents the Vigilante Eagly double feature trade paperback, which reprints the Vigilante Eagly double feature miniseries numbers 1-5, which is inspired by the Peacemaker James Gunn take on the character as seen in the Peacemaker show. Do you watch Peacemaker? Do you watch that show?
I have watched all of season one and part of season two. The opening orgy in season two is a little much for my wife.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm the same. I didn't have a problem with the orgy part, but it is the show. I find the show to be kind of like slamming down like a Arctic blast Mountain Dew while you're, you know, eating nothing but corn chips all night. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yes. I can't watch it and I can't binge watch it. So I'm doing it.
Yes.
But anyway, they have if you've seen that show, they have a very profane, unique take on the Vigilante. And here, this miniseries is, I guess, like I said, in that continuity. The cover artist is Mitch Gerads. The writers are Rex Ogle, Freddie Stroma, Tim Seeley, and the artist is Mitch Gerads and Matteo Lully. 128 pages. Normal price, $17.99. In stock trades price is only $10.79. You save 40%.
You know, I need to get on the Peacemaker comics because they did one, I don't remember which one it's called, but featuring the Red Bee. So if I'm going to keep up with my Red Bee fan fiction, I've really got to get out there and read these things. So I picked Alan Scott, The Green Lantern, trade paperback. This collects a series by the same name that came out just a few years ago. It includes the short story from DC Pride Through the Years as well. This was a six-issue miniseries that took place in the 1940s. Tells a little bit of Alan's origin, tells a little bit of what it's like for him as Green Lantern and being a gay man in the 1940s, closeted gay man in the 1940s. He develops a relationship with someone who ends up becoming the Red Lantern, a Golden Age Red Lantern. It is phenomenal. It is a great comic. I didn't know what to expect going in, right? Because a lot of the times when they tell these retroactive stories, you're like, eh, it didn't feel like the character. I thought this was phenomenal. It was really a great series. Writer is Tim Sheridan. Artist is Sion Tormey. Cover artist is David Talaski. I said all of those wrong. Page count is 144 pages. It's full color, soft cover. Normally goes for $16.99. You can get it for $10.19. That is cheaper than the fast food meal I picked up last night. So that... $10.19 for this great trade paperback. I cannot recommend it enough. It is a wonderful story. And even if you're on the fence about some of the retroactive changes about Alan Scott, I think you'll find things to enjoy in this story. It's really a wonderful tale. For these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network is so many shows. It requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting what site, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In a certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the shows of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. Our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Chuck Coletta, Mike Atchison, Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton,
Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Corey Balanecki, Noah Tarnow, Phil Becker, Steve Givens, and Tom Panarese.
Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, we will post the entries, the 13 entries we're going to cover today, and the Zooms Who entry. We're going to put those on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com in the gallery post. You can see all of them there. You leave your comments on our website as well. That's where we'll pull your feedback, just like we're going to do at the end of this. And, Rob, we've got some fun artists in here. So today we're going to be talking about art by Jerry Ordway,
Gray Morrow,
Keith Giffen,
Jack King Kirby,
Steve Dillon,
Carmen Infantino,
Murphy Anderson,
George Perez,
and more. So, you ready to get into this, buddy?
I am absolutely ready.
Why don't we fire up the randomizer, Rob? It's been you know, quiet since Thanksgiving. So, get a goose it a little and pump prime the pump and give it a rip and go for it.
Boop boop beep boop boop beep boop boop.
There we go. Excellent. All right. First entry is from issue number 3. It is Brainwave Jr. That's right. Junior's in the house. Art is by Jerry the Extraordinary Ordway. So here you've got him. He's coming at you. He's got the red bodysuit with sort of the bluish purple gloves and leggings. He's looking off to his left like he's thinking hard on something. You can see the waves of mental energy coming off him in the surprint, which is really nice. And he's got that costume that Brainwave, his father, introduced in the 70s, which was, there's a long, weird story with that. But anyway, he had that weird googly eyes and stuff. Anyway, Brainwave Jr. Hank has, you know, reclaimed that costume as his own, and he looks fantastic in it because it's Jerry Ordway. Come on. Then you've got this green surprint, and behind that, you see a very nice profile shot of Hank's face. Again, you see the waves of mental energy. You see Hank riding, it looks like a mental construct, like a surfboard. You see his mother and father. You see the original Brainwave, and you see Mary, Girl of a Thousand Gimmicks. So, what do you think of the art, Rob?
I mean, it's, as always, it's a complete masterpiece. This might be this, like, top five surprint in all of Who's Who, right? Just
it's
the
really good
in terms of how much he gets in there and the just the beautiful illustrative. I love that you've got Hank Jr., you know, slightly to looking right, and then you've got the father looking slightly left. That the little inset of the father with the giant dome head and the glasses might be my single favorite portrait in any of the surprints. Like, I just love the lighting of it. The head looks huge. And Jerry's use of Zipitone is just unmatched. You know, like, he just knows how to execute it so well. He crushed these every time, every single time. He just brought everything to it. It's a beautiful illustration. The only complaint I might make even a little bit is the logo is like a little just, you know, it's okay. It's just like a typeface. Yeah. But short of that, the rest, that's not Jerry Ordway, of course. That has nothing to do with him. But man, the artwork is just top notch.
I wonder if it's like the Brainwave logo from the bad guy from the old days and they just slapped a junior on it or something. Because since he premiered in the 80s, you think he would have had a more 80s looking logo. But either way. So I was going to ask you about that. So is it Zipitone? Is that because like if you look at the top, it almost looks like cross hatching in the top right, the way the lines kind of cross each other.
It might be a combo of all those things.
Okay.
You know, if we ever have Jerry on the show, we'd love to have look to pick his brain about that stuff because there might be duo tint board. Like he probably used all sorts of things. It's just it's so distinctive. It's just so distinctive. It's just, you know, it's beautiful stuff.
And to take that like if you look at the costume in and of itself, it's doofy. You know, it's your standard leotard, you know, red top and blue legs, whatever. And I do like the headpiece where you have the open top with the hair coming out and the goggles. I like that. But the rest of it just is a doofy costume. But you know what? It's Ordway, so he makes it look cool. So getting into the origin here. So yes, he is the son of the original Brainwave, right? And so he inherited I should point out, his mother is Mary, Girl of a Thousand Tricks, and his father is that creepy, weirdo, bald Brainwave. How did those two hook up? Like, that had to be a seriously weird first date. I was all
Brainwave got some game.
He really does. He really does. So this is the prodigy or the offspring or whatever of them. And he's got these mental powers already. Then he is sort of redeeming the name of Brainwave because his father's a supervillain. He's decided to fight on the side of right. He ends up joining Infinity Inc. And then eventually his father sacrifices himself to save Hank Jr. and transfers his mental powers to him. So Hank actually becomes even more powerful. And I love that the storyline here has lots of potential for a son using the same name as his father and trying to do the right thing. We actually talked about this sort of in the comments a while back about what people try to reclaim a villain's name and make it a hero's name. And this is one of the, you know, the best examples of that. The sad part to me is that DC, after Infinity Inc., went nowhere after a while. You know, DC kind of did the wrong thing and they ended up making him a villain. They made him like this crazy Brainwave villain. He was in Extreme Justice. It was not good. But I've always loved the concept of this character and I wanted good things to happen for him.
I like that it mentions he's currently unemployed. Like, that's just funny. You don't generally see that a whole lot, right? In the listings, currently unemployed. And it mentions this is born a mutant like his father. Now, there are lots of mutants in the DC universe, but they very rarely use that word because obviously it was so thought of, right, for the X-Men. It seems like Marvel almost owned that word. I know they don't, but it just, you just generally didn't see that many of characters born with powers labeled as mutants in Who's Who, because I think DC just generally didn't use that term, but there it is, that both of them are mutants.
The other one that comes to mind for me is Captain Comet. They always called him a mutant as well.
Right.
And maybe at DC they just earmarked it for mental powers. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Kind of strange. So, as you would expect, Rob, of course he's a TV star. Brainwave Jr. has been in the Stargirl TV series. If you want more on him, you could check out A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast. You could listen to the Earth 2 podcast. You could check out the new Earth 2 website. I should have mentioned his first appearance was All-Star Squadron number 24. If I remember right, that wasn't an insert, right? They actually traveled back in time and interacted with the All-Star Squadron, didn't they?
Well, who's they?
Infinity Inc.
Did they? Yeah. Yes, they teamed up. I'm sorry. I was a little like, wait. No, it was not an insert. It was, they actually did appear in the book, in the story.
Okay. I think I was getting that confused with the All-Star Squadron insert in Justice League is what I was
thinking. No. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, the beautiful entry. Great way to kick it off. Jerry the Extraordinary. And you ready to move on?
One thing I will mention, you mentioned the open head mask, you know, thing that he's got. Not enough superheroes have that, right? Mm-hmm. The open hair. Because I don't know about you, but like when I go jogging and to stay out of the Florida heat, I bring my hat. Your head gets like sweaty really fast.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and think about how much superheroes are running around doing stuff. Like more of them should let their head breathe a little bit. You know, like if you... So many superheroes wear skin tight headgear. Try doing that for like a day and see how irritated you are after that. So that's a design I think more superheroes should have used, is the open top. Let your head breathe a little bit.
I was looking at a cosplayer video not too long ago, and she was basically talking about the outfit she's wearing. She goes, yeah, inside of this, everything is sweat. everything.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah, like, I mean, you get Brainwave Jr. with the exposed hair. It's basically a cowl that's open topped, you know.
Yeah.
You get Brainwave Jr., you get Wally West in his, you know, his later costumes had the exposed hair as Kid Flash. You get Gambit, you get Cyclops in his later years with the exposed hair. It just looks cooler.
It it's cool.
Than the dome. Yep. So as a bald person, you don't want to see the shape of someone's head. You want to see hair. So I know. I took a shot of both of us. All right. Up next is Captain Compass. This is from issue number 4. It goes from one win to another win, man. Artist is Gray Morrow. You know, the famous Gray Morrow, who I didn't know when we started Who's Who, by the way. I've been educated as we've gone along over these 12 years. Or no, 14 years. Learning about Gray Morrow and just how impressive he is. Here you've got Captain Compass. He's in his, like, naval uniform. On the left-hand side, you see the full shot of him there in his uniform. Kind of a little casual. Got his hand in his pocket. Then in the surprint, you've got a close-up shot of his face with the hat on. Then you've got a ton of Zippotone all over it. And it's interesting. There's weird shapes in the Zippotone that you can't really make out. But then you see, you know, inset there is a, like, scuba diver. You see a picture of a giant steamship or a whatever the Titanic, whatever you kind of call those types of ships.
Like a steamer ship. Stacks.
Yeah. And it's gorgeous. And it's only half page, by the way, I should mention. What do you think of this image? I think it's great.
I mean, it's Gray Morrow. The font rules. I wish I had that font in my Photoshop library. I would use it on, like, everything that I end up doing design work for. Love it. I've always loved Gray Morrow. Gray Morrow, you know, it's one of those guys. It's like, it's not flashy, right? It's kind of it's very realistic proportions. Even when he did his superheroes, it was never, you know, overly done, but yet it's just really beautifully drawn. Yeah, I love it. And this is, we've now done this whole page because the other half is Captain Fear, which we did a couple of months ago on, or a couple episodes ago on Who's a Review. Great stuff. Just, I love that they gave him a listing because, you know, he's not really a current character. Now, do you want to guess? It says his first appearance was Star Spangled Comics number 63. Do you want to, or 83, excuse me. Do you want to guess? We like to do this. How many issues he ran in Star Spangled Comics?
I'm going to guess nearly 50 issues.
Pretty close. He went from 83 to 130,
and then maybe 20 issues in Detective Comics.
There you go. Yes, he jumped. He jumped to Detective Comics, and then his last appearance by the time of this publication was in Detective Comics number 500, where they did all the detective characters from the series appearing with Batman. So yeah, I love that they gave him a listing, even though he's getting sort of out of circulation for a while. But yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
I was so ready to spring that on you. You know, I like to ask that of you. So I didn't expect you to have that. So yeah, the fact that this guy got over 70 appearances blew my mind. That's crazy. And yeah, so yeah, he disappears. He's basically in the 1940s and 50s. And then, like you said, they just bring him back every so often for a Detective Comics, like, cameo type thing. And what a cool. So the idea here is, again, in the 40s and 50s, it's essentially detective stories on the high seas, right?
Yeah.
The early stories are exclusively detective fiction, where he gets brought in on some ship, you know, either the military sends him there or he finds his way there and has to do some sort of investigation. I guess it's like Murder, She Wrote on a Boat. I don't know. Then eventually, as time went on, they did add some supernatural elements from time to time to it. But where he fights mechanical whales and prehistoric dinosaurs, whatever. So I thought this was interesting. So the series was created by Jimmy Thompson. But do you know who the regular penciler was on these strips?
I do not.
Paul Norris.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, Aquaman's co-creator. That's great. Exactly. All right. The man was good at seafaring stories. Okay.
Exactly. Right. I thought you would dig that. Then the interesting thing is, so again, he goes over to Detective Comics, right? That he's there in Detective Comics for about 20 issues. And do you know what feature replaces him?
No.
So this character who didn't go anywhere called Martian Manhunter.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. That would be right around that time. Yeah. So, okay. Yep.
So. Very cool. So explain to me what's going on in the Zippotone here, because there's, like, weird splotchy stuff going on, but it looks cool.
I think that's just a printing. I actually think that's a flexographic printing mistake. I don't think that's intent. I don't think that's actually there. I think that's just the color is blobby.
Oh, you know what? I think I figured out what it is. So, all right. So.
A minute. You know, when I look closer, it's. Oh, you go ahead. I think I figured out what it by looking at it a little closer.
Yeah. We know exactly what it is. It's the entry on the next page coming through.
Yeah, it's bleeding through the page. That's right. Because I can see the letters there.
Yep,
Yeah,
and the
there.
leg of someone standing there.
Yep,
Okay.
there it
So,
is. There
in
it
full
is.
disclosure, Rob and I are looking at scans of these things because it's easier when we have to compile these 13, rather than sitting here flipping through stuff trying to
Yes,
find them.
yes.
We compile old scans of these things. So we're looking at a scan. So someone scanned in their book, and yeah, it's picking up from the previous page. So none of this is probably interesting to you folks, but it is to us
I
anyway.
think it is. Otherwise, why would they be listening to this show?
That is probably true. That's true.
You're here for
All
the
right.
minutia.
So, I'll see how what the randomizer sounds like with a cold. Beep, boop, 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 boop. Who's up next, Rob?
All right, we've got Captain Storm, a World War II war character who first appeared in Captain Storm number one. The drawing here is by Irv Novik and Romeo Tangel, and it's kind of a nice bring back for Irv Novik because Irv Novik was the artist on the Captain Storm series that ran 18 issues in the mid 60s. And in fact, the listing here where he is being fired upon by somebody, either well, somebody in the Axis powers, and we see the bullets are actually shooting through his wooden leg there, and then he's firing off in the distance. That is a recreation of the cover of Captain Storm number one.
Really?
There's more stuff on that cover. Like you see, he's actually on like the deck of the ship, and we see the plane firing at him. So Irv Novik basically is just referencing his own cover, but it's the same positioning where Captain Storm is sort of away from the. His face is away from the camera, that kind of thing. And so it's a recreation of that. And then we see a little inset of him, and then we see him with the losers because after Captain Storm was canceled, they moved him over as to being part of the losers, and then their losers ran in I think it's Our Army at War, I believe is the title.
Our fighting,
No, Our Fighting Forces, excuse me, Our Fighting Forces. And they ran a little bit more, and then they made a couple appearances in GI Combat, and then they were brought back for like a special where they all got killed off, basically right during the crisis, which it mentions. It says, regrettably, Captain Storm and the other losers were killed in action in the final days of the Second World War. So again, I'm glad that, these war characters that were sort of out of circulation got listings like this.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of the losers. It's kind of like a Traveling Wilburys thing where they all were independently being published and then brings them together
They're a
and
super
actually,
group. World War II super
exactly,
group. Yeah.
they're the damn Yankees. And they
Wow.
actually were more, well, it's the same thing as Traveling Wilburys. It's just different kind of music, but
How dare you?
oh my gosh.
How
Hey.
dare you compare the de Oh my God. Okay. All right.
Night Ranger and Styx helped form Damn Yankees, so back off,
That's
buddy.
the same
Anyway.
thing as Bob Dylan and a Beatle in a band. Sure, same thing.
Sure is. It's identical. It's like that GIF from The Office where it's the same picture. Anyway,
Oh,
so yeah,
man, I never
it's
had you on
crazy
Pod
that
Dylan.
there's a reason for that. Anyway, it's amazing they had 60 appearances in Our Fighting Forces. Altogether, they had over 100 appearances. It's just blows the mind that they were that popular. Now, I got to tell you, I'm glad you told me the history of this image because I didn't know it came from the cover. But I love, first of all, the image looks great. It looks phenomenal. But I am totally like, if I didn't know who the artist was, I'm totally getting Jim Aparo energy from this. Like with
I
the
can see that.
water,
Sure. Yeah.
yeah, with the angle and the water and the pose and just the face and stuff. It just feels totally Jim Aparo. Now, I'm glad you also explained this is the cover number one because the entry itself confused me. The entry itself made it sound like he gets the eye patch later after he joined the losers, which doesn't make any sense because I was pretty sure he had the eye patch from the beginning.
Yeah, he did.
So there's something not quite right there in the timeline. But either way, love seeing him on the soaking wet deck. I love seeing firing the machine gun. I didn't even notice the bullets were going through his leg. That's hilarious.
It's one of the most badass poses, right? In any Who's Who,
Yeah.
your leg is being ripped to shreds, splinters by Axis fire, and yet you're still standing up and firing back. Like you're just what an ass kicker.
Yes. Yes. And the surprint looks great. It's a red surprint. You got a close up of his face, but then you've got the losers running at you, which looks great. You see, because you see Johnny Cloud and you see Gunner and Sarge. All it's missing is Pooch, really. But it's fantastic entry. I love
Great,
this.
great stuff.
All right. So if you want more on Captain Storm, you could watch the DC Showcase animated short featuring the losers, which is so cool. Then you could also tune into the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast, where they talked a little bit about this. So, all
Okay.
right.
All right. I'll queue up the randomizer. So
Thank you.
beep boop beep beep boop beep boop beep boop beep boop.
Wow, it puttered out there, didn't it? for the Chlorophyll Kid. Now, this is from issue number 4. We've got another half-page entry here. The art is by Keith Giffen and Carl Kessel. So we're in the sort of silly era of the Legion of Substitute Heroes. And as Siskoid and everyone else pointed out to us in the comments for years and years, the Legion of Substitute Heroes started off as serious characters. They really were legitimately trying to help. It wasn't until Giffen comes along that makes them goofy, and that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the goofy era where Chlorophyll Kid looks ridiculous, right? He's wearing this, you know, very loose-fitting, almost poncho kind of outfit that is green, but then it actually has a drawing of a tree on it, and you can see the roots are coming out of his crotch. And he's got a funny cowl with leaves on it. It's very, very funny. I love this image. You got the red surprint where flowers are growing around him because he's actually zapping the ground and causing plants to grow, but the growth is only being seen in the surprint, which is kind of a cool effect. Then you got a close-up of his face without the cowl. Now, this is a great picture. It isn't quite as good as the one Ty Templeton does later down the road, which is the spitting image of Ryan Daly, which is crazy. But so Chlorophyll Kid's power is to stimulate plant growth. He fell into a tank when he's a kid. He fell into a tank of hydroponic serum, as you do, which gave him the powers to grow plants, which is sort of different because a lot of Legionnaires, you know, their whole planet has that power. He is more of a unique individual that has the power rather than everyone from his species. So he goes and he applies for a Legion of Superhero membership. He's rejected, so he goes and helps form the subs. And so they show up for decades, you know, from time to time, going and helping. And then again, eventually they kind of become a bit of a punchline. And eventually they'll become a lot more serious down the line as well. So what do you think of the art here, buddy?
Oh, it's beautiful. Now, I do have a question, though. It says rapid plant growth, right? The only, I think the only sub story I've ever read, the only two were the ones by Giffen and Robert Lauren Fleming, right? So, like, how fast? What's rapid? Like, is it like poison ivy kind of thing? Or is it like slowly? Because if it's slowly, those powers aren't terribly useful. Everyone's got to wait around for the shrub to grow. Or is it like it shoots out of the ground and it actually can be somewhat, you know, useful as a power?
So I want to tell you guys, as we said, we've been doing this show for 14 years. Rob and I have been recording together for 15 years. And also, just FYI, this year is also the 10th anniversary of the Firewater Podcast Network. And Rob, you asking that question is the perfect celebration of everything we've done for the last 15 years, because it's all laid out right here in the entry. And it's literally only two paragraphs you had to read, man. But that's
I did
okay.
read it.
I'll
what are
you
talking about?
Chlorophyll Kid can stimulate rapid plant growth, such as turning an acorn into an oak in seconds, and carries various seeds in his belt for suitable contingencies.
No, okay. What I all right? I'm sorry. What I'm
turns
trying
in seconds. He turns an acorn in seconds to an oak tree.
Okay. What I am saying is, when he does that, does he control? Like, is it like poison ivy? Right? Poison ivy. I'm sorry. Poison ivy can make plants grow, and then she controls them so she can, like, strangle Batman with it says he can grow things. Okay, it just grows a tree, and then what?
Correct.
Like, it's just a tree there.
Right. He cannot control the tree, but, you know, he could grow it to act as cover, or, you know, if they're shelter. He could grow some sort of weird flower that grows and then spits some sort of pollen in somebody's face. So he can do various things, but, yeah, he cannot control the plant.
All right.
Correct.
Okay. Fair enough.
And way to poo-poo poor Raul Benham. I mean, he's a good guy. I mean, come on, jeez. The logo's a little generic. It just looks like someone wrote the letters. It could be a little more plant-like, but I'm sure it goes back to the 60s or something, probably. First appearance is Adventure Comics number 306. Of course, you can find more about him on the Legion of Super Bloggers or the Legion of Superheroes animated series.
Okay. And hosting Cheers Cast and Nightcast.
That's true. So here we go. Randomizer says, beep boop. Oh, here, I know what the randomizer is going to say for this one. Beep boop, 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 boop,
boop. Yes, and next listing is Dr. Destiny, who first appeared way back in Justice League of America number 5. He kind of looks like Skeletor, really, if you just go by his face. It's drawn by Rudy Nebrez. I put made his name into a portmanteau there. In the inset, we see him as in the projection that he shoots to people. So this is what they see when they don't want to see, when he doesn't want people to see his skull face. And a recreation of the cover to JLA number 5, which is Rudy Nebrez is doing that. We see Aquaman and Wonder Woman in these little test tubes. And that's a recreation of the cover. He's always been one of the JLA's Great Foes. He, I think my favorite story of his was in JLA Annual Number 1, which featured a guest appearance by the Sandman. He's, you know, he's come back to menace the Justice League a bunch of times. For someone with as many power, like sort of an interesting power set, his powers and weapons are like two sentences. Dr. Desert's greatest weapon is his superior mind, which enabled him to construct the Materiopticon, through which he can make people's nightmares a reality, and the anti-gravity discs that enabled him to fly. Which I love that like he's had this other thing that has nothing to do with being like a dream projector, which is like, oh, he can also do anti-grav discs. You're like, okay, that is not related to anything else, but okay, that's fine.
I have lots of questions. Okay. So first let's start with the art. The Serpent image looks great. You're right, he does look a lot like Skeletor, very much so. What is going on with that left hand? If you really look at it, like, what is happening there?
It's he's got his thumb tucked like way under. It does look a little odd.
The forearm, the way that the angle of it, yeah.
A little bit of a wonky anatomy here.
Yeah. By the way, Rudy, after this, I get he did a lot of work throughout the 70s and stuff, but he didn't do a lot of work after this. After this, he did some stuff for Continuity Press and a little bit for Marvel, but not much more.
Yeah, I think this was at the tail end of his career in comics.
So reading this entry is generated a lot of questions for me, because to me, he is the dream bad guy, right? He's the, he's the Freddy Krueger, whatever. All this first paragraph talks about, like, his first time he appeared, he just had anti-gravity powers. Mm-hmm. No dreams, like none of that. And they also say he didn't look all skeletal back then. It sounds like the third or fourth appearance is when he becomes like the dreamless skull face thing. Are those all retcon stories or something? Like,
no. The inset is he did look like that in JLA number 5. The Serpent, new Rudy Nebrez is combining that cover with what he looks like now.
Okay. All right. So it's just weird that they talk all about these anti-gravity discs, and the dream stuff doesn't even come in until like the second paragraph or something. Yeah. It's just so strange for me, because I was confused, because he's the dream guy, right? Some of my favorite appearances, there was a great story Dan Jurgens did after Superman died. And it's the name of it. It was like a 5-part story. It's totally escaped me. But like they revisited the satellite era of the JLA, but it was a dark, twisted mirror version. It all had to do with Dr. Destiny. It was really cool. Then, of course, that annual you mentioned is very good. But for me, the most interesting Dr. Destiny story is also the most disturbing, which is that issue of Neil Gaiman's Sandman, where he's in the diner and he just messes with people for 24 hours. And it's just – do you remember that story at all?
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. And it really it freaked me out. And it's interesting to note that it's just 4 years after this issue was published. So after this Who's Who came out, it's only 4 years later that Gaiman does that. So I do have a question. Like, prior to that Sandman appearance, because that's really where it sticks out in my mind, was when Dr. Destiny showed up, was it like a big deal? Was he like, ooh, he's scary? Or was he just like, you know, like Felix Faust doesn't do anything for me. So is it like, oh, okay, it's that guy again.
Well,
or was it like a big deal or what?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, he was part of the, you know, contrary to what you just said, like Felix Faust or Dr. Light or, well, not Dr. Light, but, you know, Amos Fortune, like they're or the Star of the Conqueror. They were these villains that were from the first 2 years of the book, and then they would come back every so often and menace the JLA. So I always, and again, he was the villain in JLA Annual Number 1, which is an extra long story. Right. So he was, you know, he's like one of their kind of big villains.
Okay. I just, the early JLA, out of all the JLA villains you just mentioned, the only one I ever even considered interesting was Starro. Rest of them just don't do anything. Like Amos Fortune, really? I mean, just none of them do anything for me. So interesting. First appearance, as you said, is Justice League America number 5. You can find more of him on in the DC animated universe, like the new Batman Adventures. He showed up in Justice League. He showed up. JLU. He showed up. He was in the Arrowverse, because of course he was. And they also put him in the Sandman TV show as well. So really cool stuff. Love the art. And I'll get you, Justice League, is probably what he yells at the end of that. That was a Skeletor reference.
I got it. Yeah.
I didn't know. You're not a He-Man guy, so I don't know.
I play like T-Man. What are you talking about? I like T-Man.
Just do the randomizer.
All right. Beep, boop, beep, beep, boop, 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 boop.
Okay, up next is Glorious Godfrey, art by Jack Kirby and Bob Smith. This is from issue number 9 of Who's Who. The logo's a little boring, probably from one of the New Gods issues, I imagine. Occupation is revelationist. I love that. So he is an orator with incredibly persuasive powers. And the history here basically outlines his mission to Earth to spread his rhetoric and unrest that would help pave the way for Darkseid. And in the story here, they do explain, sadly, how he was beat by the Forever People. Poor guy. Just that's an albatross around your neck. But here we go. So we've got him, Jack Kirby art. He's standing there. He's got, you know, his white top and his orange pants and purple boots, and he's got his red hair and his big cape with red cape. And then and he's kind of reaching his hand out like he's, you know, he's doing almost like a revival kind of thing there. Then in the serpent, you've got a side profile shot of him. You got him with his little henchmen, his personal army, the Justifiers. And then you've got the Forever People beating up on his Justifier. So what do you think of this one, buddy?
Now, if you had questions about the anatomy of Dr. Destiny's arm, I wanted you to talk about Glorious Godfrey's left arm, because what is happening?
that elbow is really close to you.
I mean, it's not for me to question the work of the greatest innovator in the history of the comic book form, but this anatomy is pretty wonky.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, it's only the arm. Like, if you take the arm out of it, the rest of it's pretty okay, probably. But either way. So here's a question for you. So first appearance is Forever People number 3. And I think it's fair to say, you know what, I'll just say it's an inarguable fact. The best usage of Glorious Godfrey is in the Legends miniseries. He is absolutely amazing in that thing. Guess how many appearances he had before the Legends miniseries.
I'm going to guess, by the way you're asking this, very few, that he only basically probably appeared in the New Gods books, and then when those were canceled, never again, probably.
Yeah, 3 appearances.
Wow, even less than I thought. Okay.
And I think they're all in Forever People. Like, it's just shocking because to me, you know, where I, you know, stepped into the larger world of DC, whether it was Crisis and Legends, you know, Glorious Godfrey's a big freaking deal. He was a huge deal in Legends, and he's been around. He's made a million appearances since then. But to think that prior to Legends, he'd only had 3 appearances. Like, I wonder what sparked John Ostringer to use him as such a mouthpiece. Like, was he going through Who's Who or something? I don't know. But it's interesting to me that he picked a character that barely ever appeared to make him such a tentpole character in that way. I don't know. Do you have a fondness for Legends, or is it not really your best?
Oh, no. I thought Legends was terrific. Legends was great. Okay. Really enjoyed it. And he was used incredibly effectively in that. I can imagine that Ostrander was like, I need a character who's a kind of revivalist, huckster kind of thing, Lonesome Rhodes kind of guy. What do we have? Who's in the, oh, wait a minute, there's this character. You know, do I have to create my own? Oh, no, we've already got one. Maybe it was just something like that.
I don't know. It worked great, though.
Yeah.
So, and then since then, of course, you can find him in the Justice League cartoon. He's been on Smallville. He was on Young Justice, voiced by Tim Curry. That's pretty cool.
Oh, that's fun. I didn't know that. That's fun.
Superman and Lois. Of course, Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box did a big Legends coverage a few years back as well. So those are all great places to find more on him. I love this character. I think he's fascinating. I think he deserves to be in the public consciousness to look at how people can manipulate people with words. And we'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, up next, boo, 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 in Darkest Night, boo, 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 in Blackest Day, whatever that goes. Anyway, Brightest Day. we have what I consider to be the tentpole entry of the book here. We have Green Lantern Alan Scott from issue number 9, my beloved Who's Who number 9, the first issue of Who's Who I ever bought. Art here is George Freeman, and it is freaking gorgeous. The only downside is that they had to make it small because there's so much text, but it is this great shot of Alan. He's standing there. He's got his arms out. His ring, of course, you know, ring finger is pointing at you. He's youthful, probably in the 1940s. The wind is whipping his cool freaking hair. His hair looks awesome. That logo is so boss, especially for a Golden Age logo with the Green Lantern, you know, on each side of the green and lantern on each side of the lantern with flames all around it. And then the serpent, you have him creating a construct and picking up a bad guy who's running away with money. You see the train with him holding the lantern, but it's all askew. And then you see him really close to the microphone giving a radio performance in his secret identity. And then you see him charging his ring. This is got to be one of the greatest pieces of the original Who's Who. And I don't know that I ever paid enough attention in the past. It is gorgeous.
Yeah, no argument on that. George Freeman didn't do a lot of superhero work. He did a lot of independent stuff. I've always was always a big fan of his. But yeah, this is absolutely, I love the movement, the cape, you know, like
Yeah.
you feel like there's this gust of air, or that like he's just arrived or something. He's just landed and the cape is still fluttering. Yeah, this is, I could see why you don't want to give him 2 pages, but as you just said, I wish they had so this piece could breathe a little, because it is so beautifully drawn. This is one of those that I'm like, how did they pair this up? Because as far as I can recall, George Freeman never did anything Green Lantern related. He did do some Batman stuff for DC, but I don't think he ever did anything for Green Lantern. So I don't know how he ended up doing this, but boy, yeah, it's a phenomenal piece.
And just the detail in the serpent on the train, and again, just the way he composed, just Alan talking to a microphone.
Yeah,
Like,
he's
it
kind of
looks
leaning into the
so,
frame a little.
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's
You
wonderful.
can just barely see the microphone, so it's enough to tell you what you need to know. Like, artistically, it's genius.
Yeah.
So I'm totally wowed by this thing. The origin here, it's sort of crazy. It goes into they tie it to the Earth One Green Lanterns and the Guardians of the Universe. For me, the way they explain it is they say that there's the Star Heart. So the Guardians of the Universe, they banished magic energies from the cosmos. They put it in this mystical orb called the Star Heart. And a portion of that Star Heart, known as the Green Flame of Life, escaped to the parallel world of Earth Two. I thought that was all a post-crisis retcon. So I'd be interested for you folks at home to write in and let me know, when did that retcon happen? Because obviously, you know, when Alan was created in the 40s, none of this Earth One, Earth Two nonsense was around, or the Guardians Universe and all that. So I'd be interested to know when that retcon happened, because I thought it happened in post-crisis. So I'm shocked to find it happened that early. Now, you pay attention though to this entry, because we're going to talk about this again. You know, ages ago, the Guardians of the Universe decided to, in order to preserve the rule of order of the cosmos, they must remove most mystical energies from it. They gathered together most magical forces in the universe. Yada 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 yada. It's going to come back later, guys. So that's just a tip off for you. Anyway, so this Star Heart falls to Earth on Earth Two centuries ago as a meteor, and it announces that 3 times I shall flame green: first to bring death, second to bring life, third to bring power. Well, Alan Scott was lucky; he was the third guy, and so he gets the ring. He was a train engineer, and they're crossing this bridge, and the bridge was blown up by a rival company. And Alan just happened to be holding that Green Lantern at that moment; it saved him. And then he gets it and uses his powers for good, becomes a founding member of the JSA. In fact, he becomes the second chairman of the JSA, and he joins the All-Star Squadron. And it's sort of interesting that they do mention here in the Powers and Weapons how he started off with less power, and how he just simply became more and more powerful as time went on, which is sort of interesting. Then, unfortunately, in Powers and Weapons, they do mention Ian Carcool, so can't win them all.
Your favorite.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! So overall, what are you? Are you in? Who's your favorite Green Lantern?
I don't even know. I don't know if I've ever really thought to have one. Probably this one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I liked Green Lantern, the Hal Jordan, but I just never like particularly favorite. But I loved his costume, right? This should not work, right? This should not work. Purple, green, red, yellow. You've got the straps on the boot. Like it's a crazy ass costume. But it's absolutely wonderful. By the way, it mentions that he was his base of operations formerly Gotham City. He was set in Gotham City in the
Yes.
early days, and then they moved him to Keystone because I think they were like, I think Batman, that's kind of Batman's turf, right?
Probably
That's
true.
exclusively his city. So then they moved him over to Keystone City. But yeah, I always love this character. I just thought he was, and I liked that, you know, you could just hit him with a block of wood and that would knock him out. It's like, what a weakness.
The number of times he got smacked across the back of the head,
Hit him with a
ridiculous.
2x4, and it's the most powerful weapon. He's out. He's out. He's out. He's out. But
At least
yeah.
when Aquaman, Aquaman gets knocked out by 2x4s all the time, at least Green Lantern has a reason for it to work,
True. True. It was never great. But yeah, I love that they pulled the logo from the old comic book series. Like, that's great. Like, that's how popular he was, is that he ran in 2 books concurrently in the 40s. Not to mention appearing in All-Star Comics with the Justice League. He had his own series and was in All-American Comics. So, I mean, he was pretty popular back then.
So I know I've told the story before, but I don't care. I'll tell it again. So when I was a kid, in my late teens, I was reading comics. I don't know what I was reading. Probably an All-Star Squadron or a Crisis. I don't know. Whatever I was reading, and I was reading it, and my mom happened to walk by. And my mother, in all of my life at that point, had never expressed an interest in comics other than she was willing to buy them for me. She's walking by. Alan Scott happened to be on the page, and she goes, "Oh, hey, that's Green Lantern. That's a Green Lantern. She goes, that's a Green Lantern I remember from growing up. And I'm like, what?
Hmm.
So she suddenly, we were talking comics. She apparently growing up had read some, so because she had seen the other Green Lantern stuff around the house, and that wasn't Green Lantern to her. But when she saw this guy, she's like, oh, that's Green Lantern. That's a Green Lantern I remember. And then we got talking. The two characters she remembered were Green Lantern and Rubberman. And we went on and on about Rubberman for a very long time till I finally convinced her she's actually talking about Plastic Man. But we got
okay.
there.
Okay.
So, so Alan Scott, as far as my favorite Green Lantern, thanks for asking.
Look,
my
needed
favorite,
to ask you that.
My favorite is probably Kyle Rayner, just because I imprinted on him so much in the 90s. He was a Gen Xer. I was a Gen Xer. We were both in our 20s. It was just everything synced up. But I would say Alan Scott is a very close second, right behind Kyle. And it's probably more, again, more just the time of my life that I read Kyle versus, I think Alan's got cooler stuff going on. But anyway, I love this character, and I love talking about him on the JSA Presents show. So his first appearance is all the way back in All-American Comics number 16. Of course, you can find more of him by listening to the JSA Presents podcast, JSA in the 90s, right here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. You can also listen to Lantern Cast, A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, the Earth 2 podcast. You can check out the new Earth 2 website. Then he has appeared in various places in television. Justice League cartoon. There was an episode with the Justice Guild. I don't know if you remember that one. They had sort of a faux Justice Society. So rather than Justice Society, they had the Justice Guild. They had the Green Guardsmen. And it was voiced by William Catt. I didn't know that. Then he appeared on Smallville. He was on Batman, the Brave and the Bold. And he had very, very, very brief cameos in Young Justice and Stargirl.
Right.
All right, Rob. The next one is all you, buddy.
Beep, boop, boop, beep, beep, boop, beep, 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 cue. IQ.
You got to sound smarter than that.
that's if I could, I would. It's IQ. First appeared in Mystery in Space number 87, a Hawkman villain. Here he's drawn by Murphy Anderson, and because he's got these little rocket sleds that he's on, we don't get to see the little elfin booties that Murphy Anderson loves drawing.
You stole my joke. I was going to make the same
there
joke.
There you go. Yeah. I was confused that he first appeared in Mystery in Space number 87, yet he's a Hawkman villain. I'm like, wait, how? And I went and looked it up, and for whatever reason, they gave Hawkman a 3-issue run in Mystery in Space, and then they moved him back out, and they let Adam Strange take over the book. Or Adam Strange was in the book before Hawkman, and then Hawkman had 3 issues, and then bang, back to just Adam Strange. Why they did that, I have no idea. Hawkman had his own series. They could have just done this on Hawkman, but for whatever reason, he is a Hawkman villain. And it's basically he's a subpar athlete and hand-to-hand combatant, as you might guess from his name. IQ prefers to rely on the super scientific devices conjured up by his highly stimulated mind. He's included a lift rod capable of lifting a heavy armored car into the air, and his ever-present aero shoes, which enable IQ and his men to literally skate on air. And so there's the little air shoes. There you go.
There's this whole thing in his origin where he keeps getting exposed to something in a museum or something like that, which is what's making him super smart. And then eventually the super smartness just sticks. But he goes on to fight more than just Hawkman and Hawkwoman. He also fights Adam Strange.
Yes.
He fights Superman and the Metal Men. And he fights, oddly enough, Batman and Superboy. I don't really know how that team-up ever happened. But he is a lesser light in the DC pantheon. Let's
yes.
just put it that way.
Yes, that's true.
He's got his ascot. He's got kind of like jompers or pants, or is that how you say that?
Yeah, those jodpers. Yeah, he looks like an old-timey movie director. Yeah.
Yeah. He looks ridiculous. He's unimpressive. And
why does he look ridiculous? I kind of like that he doesn't have a costume. It's more like clothes. It's not, you know what I mean?
I guess so. But he's got the superhero gloves, and he's got rocket shoes. I mean, he's got goggles. I mean, it is kind of a superhero costume. So or supervillain, whatever. It's ridiculous. But either way, he's never made it into other media other than some comic book tie-ins for cartoons. So he didn't make it in Batman Brave and the Bold, but he made it in the Batman Brave and the Bold comic book. And then he didn't make it in the more recent Super Friends stuff, but he made it in the Super Friends comic book. So he got a little of exposure, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, again, certainly not one of the big villains. But when you're a Hawkman villain, you know, you got to do what you can. Because Hawkman didn't have, you know, like a really great rogues gallery. And I can say that as an Aquaman fan.
That is true.
Yeah, and the logo is a little wonky, kind of, but...
They tried.
Yeah, they did.
All right, Ira Quimby, we'll miss you. All right. Boo. Neptune Perkins. Yeah. From issue number 16, artist by Mike Clark and Bill Collins. So you might know Neptune Perkins from the Young All-Stars, but this is exactly 1 year before the Young All-Stars book comes out. So we're still in the early days. They haven't made that leap yet. So what we're looking at is Neptune Perkins. He looks like at the bottom of the ocean, probably. And he's got his foot propped up on a rock because you can see some shells and stuff there. He's got his hand out like he's a restaurant greeter. Welcome to my restaurant. And he's got little bubbles coming up from his mouth. And he's holding his book under his arm that he's writing. He's got long black hair. And he's only thing he's wearing is, you know, swimming trunks and gloves and boots that cover his finned appendages. Then in the surprint's where the magic's actually happens here. The surprint is dark blue, and you've got a close-up of his face, which looks great, honestly. You see him swimming with all the bubbles around him. You see a turtle. You see him as a baby with his father putting him in the water because he needs to be. Then you see him on a riding, cresting a giant wave that is being controlled by Tsunami from the All-Star Squadron comics, and Starman's there blasting the wave as well. So I love the surprint. The front image doesn't do a lot for me. What do you think of this one?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I wish that he was bigger in the foreground. He would wish he was sort of the surprint wasn't the same scale as the main figure. His giant web feet always look a little silly to me. Yeah, they tried to use him as the replacement for Aquaman and Young All-Stars, and it didn't really work. How do you want to guess how many Golden Age appearances he had before he got retconned into All-Star Squadron?
I did not do this research, so this is fun. Okay, so he first premiered in Flash Comics number 66 mm-hmm. in 1945. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go for a low number. I'm going to say 10.
Two.
Oh, my gosh.
Two. Seriously? Flash Comics 66, Flash Comics 81, and then not again for 40 years until he came back into All-Star Squad.
Wow. So that is insane.
Roy Thomas really doing him a solid.
He really did, yeah. Now, I liked it. The Young All-Stars as a book was, for me, was not that enjoyable to read. However, I loved it conceptually. Those first six covers by Brian Murray were just gorgeous. I love the idea behind the Young All-Stars. I still think it's a good idea. It just, the book itself wasn't great in execution. So subbing him in, that's an intentional joke, for Aquaman, I think works pretty well. The big difference here is, according to this, he can't breathe underwater. He can only hold his breath for 7 minutes.
That doesn't work.
Right, exactly. You can't really be the water hero if you can't breathe water.
No.
So I did do some research. I didn't do what you did, but so he appears in Flash Comics in 1945. I sat here and wondered, why do we have this guy if we already have Aquaman? And it occurred to me. So Aquaman's in More Fun Comics, right, in 1941, mm-hmm. which is published by National Allied Publications or Detective Comics. Flash Comics is published by All American. So I think they were trying to get their own Aquaman is maybe what they were trying to do. But clearly didn't, you know, catch fire.
Didn't take. Well, of course he didn't catch fire. He was a water character. But it didn't. Just two appearances, and that's it for Neptune Perkins. So
his shtick is that he needs water. I'm sorry, he needs salt. He needs a tremendous amount of salt. He's got a salt deficiency, so he has to absorb salt through his skin. So that's why he's always in the salt water to help him survive. And the interesting thing is, one of his shticks was he was working on a book about marine life. That's his thing. He's really into. And you see him here with the book sort of under his arm there. What I don't understand is, how does he write a book with the pages getting wet? I don't get that. Is he a grease pencil on plastic, maybe? I don't really know. Something's not quite right there. Then there's this throwaway line about how Neptune Perkins and Hawkman teamed up and traveled to another planet. I'm wondering if maybe now if that's that second appearance by him. Because it's sort of wedged in here. What happened here?
The story is called Voyage to Venus. So probably.
There we go. So, yeah, 1 year later, Roy Thomas, he uses him in All-Star Squadron. Then 1 year later, he uses him in Young All-Stars. Really has never made it into other media at all. But you can find more of him on A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, the Earth 2 podcast, and the new Earth 2 website. And that's all I've got to say about that.
Next up, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 boop. Queen Bee. I'm a King Bee, baby. I want you to be my queen. Drawn by Steve Dillon. From Preacher.
Yep.
Very, very early gig from Steve Dillon. I wonder how they landed on him. Wonderfully drawn. Takes a character who is incredibly doofy looking and makes her look kind of cool, kind of menacing. The surprint has this really pissed off face. In the background, we see her taking on Batman and Superman and Flash. Her first appearance is Justice League of America number 23, and we even see Batgirl. She is from an alien planet, and she's a would-be queen conqueror. She creates a whole thing of bee men. You can imagine. It's a bunch of bee stuff. And she tangles with the Justice League and then loses, and then later on she kind of became sort of like a Green Lantern villain, which makes sense because she's from outer space. But man, beautifully drawn by Steve Dillon. And you know, I mean, I loved Preacher. That's like one of the last comic series I can remember that I read from like stem to stern. But man, just a wonderful illustration.
So Steve Dillon, this is interesting. I think this is his first DC work ever. So he started getting published work around 1979. He drew for Marvel UK.
Right.
So he drew a Nick Fury series. And more importantly, where I know Steve Dillon from, and I have since I was a little kid, he drew the Doctor Who strip. And did some amazing Doctor Who work. I used to have a T-shirt that he drew since like the early 90s of a Doctor Who character he did. Then he goes on to work for Quality UK, and he does a character called Laser and Press Button. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. They made it over here as Eclipse. So he also works for Fleetway, and he does Judge Dredd. So really, the first time he's published in America was by Eclipse, which is Laser and Press Button. So I'm wondering if that is how he helped make the leap here to DC to do this entry. It's like somehow they noticed him on Eclipse or something like that. I don't know. But I think this is probably his first real mainstream U.S. art or published art he's ever had.
Great stuff.
It really looks great, yeah. So they evolve. Her species evolves from insects. They obviously have wings. Do they have anything else that's insecty at all, or is it just the wings?
I think it's just the wings. I don't think she has like a stinger hanging out her backside or anything like that.
All right. And reading the entry here, there's a lot of weird stuff going on here. Like they talk about how all the queen bees have been obsessed with finding this elixir that keeps people young and healthy. And it just seems a little sexist to me to make all the female characters from this planet like obsessed with youth and beauty. It just seemed like, okay, that's and then it goes on to say like she does eventually get immortality, and it says like Hector Hammond, she found out that immortality brings immobility. Really? Is that a thing? Has anyone told Vandal Savage that? I mean, like, you're supposed to be frozen, I guess. I don't know. But the thing I don't like about this entry is the way it's written. It's like this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens.
It feels that's like your least favorite, entry. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did a little research on her. So she's active in the 1960s and 70s. Then she mostly disappears. Then post-crisis, the post-crisis queen bee doesn't really have any – I mean, she might have had mind powers. I don't know. But she is just super manipulative, and she controls all kinds of people in Bialya in the Justice League International book. That's the queen bee there, and she's super sexy as well. Then in 1999, Grant Morrison reimagines this version of the queen bee, the Zazalza one, and makes her more insectoid-like with, like, segmented eyes. But also, they just – woof – they ramp up the sex appeal on that version. And it's like, oh, it gets hot in here. But there's been a lot of versions since then as well. But it's an interesting character. I mean, the 60-70 version, I'm sorry, she's doofy. But by the 90s, she's pretty cool, I think.
Yes. I mean, I like this version drawn by Steve Dillon. Her hair is actually listed as magenta, which is rare, right? And we see the purple. Her hair is actually kind of purple. I like that they matched it to the listing colors, like the little colors. Yeah. Although that was nice. This has always been kind of a silly character. Of course, she evolved from the bee people. But I just love how menacing she looks as drawn by Steve Dillon. It's just great stuff.
Steve Dillon took another would-be potentially disastrous thing and turned into a really nice piece. So really nice. Yeah. And once again, another Justice League villain. So she's from Justice League of America number 23. Mm-hmm. So once again, reinforcing my point that those early Justice League villains are not very inspiring. But you can find more of her on of course, if you want to hear about the post-crisis Queen Bee, you can listen to the Justice League International Blah Ha 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 podcast. It's a great show. I recommend it highly. But she also appeared on Justice League Unlimited. The Bialyan Queen Bee was also in Young Justice. She's been in video games and comic tie-ins to cartoons. So she's gotten out there quite a bit. I used to get Queen Bee and Insect Queen mixed up all the time. So
It's easy because she looks a little like Lana Lang.
Yep.
So okay.
All right. So beep, boop, 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 boop.
All right, next up is Ran, or Ron, Adam Strange's base of operation, not his home planet. He goes to Ron. First appeared in Showcase number 17, is drawn by Carmen Infantino and Murphy Anderson. This is, I feel like this is just such a missed opportunity, this piece. I know that like they want to like show the whole planet, but part of the, when I was a kid and I watched that show Video Comics, which I've gone on and on about, you know, over the years, that Nickelodeon show that like literally just read DC Comics to you and had a narrator. They did Adam Strange stories, and that might have been maybe not my first viewing of Adam Strange, but certainly my first viewing of Adam Strange as a solo star. He appeared in JLA. He guest starred in JLA a lot. But I think I'd never read an Adam Strange solo comic. And the camera gliding across Carmen Infantino's incredible cityscapes of the of this planet really made Adam Strange look so cool. And you don't see a lot of that here. It's really mostly the shot of the planets, and then you see the stuff in the inset, or then the surprint. But you don't, I don't know. To me, Ron is this sort of gleaming surface that looks futuristic, and you just don't get much of that here, unfortunately. So I think this is a little bit of a, I'm swinging a miss for me on this one.
I actually felt the other way. I felt like this was really impressive for Carmine and Murphy, just because they do something different. You know, they focus on the planet, but then the surprint, I mean, you do have to sit here and really stare at it.
Yeah, it's a lot of detail.
A lot of detail. Really, I mean, they must have drawn this thing huge to make this work, because you got like on the left side, you got four different quadrants. Basically, you've got like these volcanic eruptions. You've got Adam and Alana flying. I assume that's Alana flying through the air over craggy landscape. You've got looks like old ruins, and then you've got that cityscape you were talking about that looks so nice.
Yeah, it's just hard to see. You know, to me, it's just hard to see. It's fine. Like it's serviceable to me. Most of the location listings in Who's Who are just serviceable. Like, okay, we have to, this is the place of the setting of a lot of stories. We need to do a listing. Like, it's just fine.
Interesting. They include the first appearance this time.
They do. They normally don't do that.
So I was reading the entry. There's a lot of history here about Ran, and what a horrible history this planet has had. Like, there's been many different previous inhabitants of Ran. You know, I guess there's these blue furry race they talk about. There's a reptilian race. Then they talk about the human shared Ran with another blue skinned race. I guess they were going for like a colonialism sort of angle here to show where like the new Ranians displaced everyone else. I don't know. Or maybe it's just like the kooky Silver Age stories where like some random alien shows up and he's like, oh, I used to live on Ran or something like that. I don't know. But there's tons of wars and destruction and dictators and ultimate weapons. I mean, they really, really have a lot here to work with. And they talk about there's no nations, only city states, and then they've been conquered several times in recent years. That's because they throw up the white flag every time Thanagar gets near them, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I like the piece artistically. I actually am really impressed with it. I'm sorry it didn't work for you, but I like it.
All right. Okay.
And for more on Ran, you could look on the Being Carter Hall blog, the Hawkman blog, or Adam Strange has appeared in extra media a lot, so I'm guessing Ron comes with that probably, like Batman Brave and the Bold, Young Justice. He was actually on Krypton, which is, I never watched that show, but that's kind of a clever idea. And then he's been in a bunch of the more recent DC animated movies, which apparently are called the Tomorrowverse. I don't know what that's about.
Okay. Did you read the Alan Moore Swamp Thing run? Did you read that book?
I have read just a little bit of it, not much.
Because there's a whole run where Swamp Thing goes to Ron. Mm. And and it starts with, because you know how Adam Strange works, right? He has to find where the Zeta beam is going to hit, and he's got to be there. There's this great opening gag where we see this blonde guy furiously running into in a mall and running into a bathroom. And he finds the stall and he starts grabbing the door, and there's a guy in there using the facilities. And this guy is like, get out, get out, get out. And the guy is literally got his pants down. Like, what the hell? And he gets thrown out. And then the blonde guy shuts the door and we see this beam and he disappears. And it was the Zeta beam was going to hit that bathroom. And that was Adam Strange having to get the guy out of the bathroom lest he be sent across the universe. Great gag. That was an absolutely fantastic gag.
That is hilarious. I was going to say earlier, I mean, there's no character in the DC Universe that has worked so hard to get laid more than Adam Strange. Because, I mean, he goes wherever that Zeta beam is just so he can get to
a lot of stuff. Man. Yep. Good. Fun stuff.
All right. So up next, beep, boop, 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 we are going to see The Terminator. to be exact. It is Deathstroke, the Terminator.
No, it so just says the Terminator here. What are you talking
about? I know,
about?
I know. Like, I wonder what that copyright battle is with the. Like, it, didn't the James Cameron movie like have to credit this or which what? No, because the James Cameron movie came out first, didn't it? Wait, this... it wasn't even James Cameron, was it?
Yes, I'm James Cameron. Yes, James Cameron is the director of the first Terminator film. Yes.
Okay.
I think this character predates the movie. This listing doesn't, but the character does. I think.
Well, wasn't there? Was that the? I again blame it on the cold medicine, folks. Was that the movie where they had to credit a DC character?
No, I think you're thinking of Karate Kid.
Nah, that is probably what I'm thinking of. Okay,
Karate Kid has a credit, has a reference in the credits. I don't think the Terminator does.
Okay. Irregardless of all that, this is drawn by George Perez, so you know it is freaking amazing. So you've got Slade there in his total blue and orange outfit. You know, the mask is on. He's got the staff. He's got the machine gun. He's in the front there. Then behind him, there's a red serpent. You've got three different areas. In the top, he is kicking the Shaz out of both Wonder Girl and Robin in the top. Then in the middle, you see his two children, and you see his ex-wife Adelaide pointing a gun at him. She's got to take out his eye. Then beneath that, in the bottom, you see him blasting on his power staff. You see his friend Wintergreen, and you see him outside of his outfit where he's just wearing that white eye patch, which is so iconic. And he's holding looks like a brandy snifter or something. And it just and along the wall behind him, George Perez has used black ink to create bullet holes, as if like the drawing itself had been shattered, you know, with one of the eight bullet holes or whatever it is. This piece, I mean, it's George Perez. I don't have to tell you it's amazing, but it's so amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. It's George Perez, incredibly consistent, and especially doing his own characters. I do, too, love the bullet holes not being part of the serpent. I've said on other podcasts on this network that Jim Aparo was always my favorite artist in terms of rendering really violent punches. Like when someone punches, someone gets punched in a Jim Aparo drawing, it looks like their head's about to fly off. Perez is like pretty close to that, right? Because we see the shot that Robin is taking such a shot to the jaw, and we actually see little spittle flying out of his mouth.
Yep.
And then he's hitting Wonder Girl, and she looks. He was so good at making bodies look like they are just flying out of control when they've been hit, as opposed to a lot of other comic book artists where they get punched and it's like oof, you know, and like that's it. No, Robin looks like he's probably missing some teeth after this. It's great, great, great stuff. And his bow staff. This is one of those characters that had they made a Mego doll, you would have lost half the accessories right in 2 minutes because there's so much crap he comes with.
The sword, the staff, the gun. Yeah, all of it. You're right. Now, I'm not going to go to his origin. You know, he's subjected to military experiments, gets enhanced body, can use 90% of his brain. I guess I am going to do his history.
It's a lot of history for a character not that old.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Because this is issue 23, so this is what, probably 1986. So it's probably, 4 years old at this point?
Yeah.
So he... him and his wife, they have a child, who a young boy named Grant, who eventually grows up to be the Ravager and gets killed. And that's what makes Slade go after the Teen Titans, because his son took a contract and got killed. Then they has another son named what is Jericho's name? Is it just Jericho? No, he's got a name, doesn't he?
I forget. I don't know.
Whatever. No, it's Jericho, I guess. Anyway, I'm just going to look it up now. Now it's Joseph. There it is. Okay. So Joseph gets his throat cut by an assassin. Anyway, Adelaide has had enough of Slade's crap, and she goes after him for Joseph getting his throat cut and shoots him in the eye. That's how he loses his eye, his ex-wife. So note to self, don't piss off your ex-wife. I got to say, of all of the DC characters, the new original characters DC have created in the last 45 to 50 years, all right, I think Deathstroke is probably, it's fair to say, he's one of the most popular that they've created in the last 50 years. Harley Quinn is arguably the most popular character they've created in the last 50 years.
Oh, by far. But yes.
But beyond that, I mean, I think it comes down to Deathstroke or Cyborg. And it really depends on what you're exposed to. Like if you didn't watch the Teen Titans cartoons, or you didn't have kids that did or whatever, you might not even know who Cyborg is. But Deathstroke, he's been in every pretty much DC project in the last 30 years. So I think he's probably one of the biggest ones. You know his connection to Deadpool, right?
No.
Okay. So Deadpool is a ripoff of Deathstroke. I mean, shockingly, Rob Liefeld is not very creative. And Deadpool was a ripoff of Deathstroke, to the point where later writers just ran with the joke. Do you know what Deadpool's real name is?
Slade, right?
No, Deathstroke is Slade. Do you know what Deadpool's real name is?
No.
Wade Wilson.
Wade Wilson. That's Wade Wilson. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, not Slade Wilson, not... but they just Marvel just owned it and said, you know what? Why not? We ripped off Deathstroke. We're just going to give him the name Wade Wilson instead of Slade Wilson. So now Deadpool's wildly more popular than Deathstroke. But I mean, at least they paid tribute a little bit to that. So at this point in this time of publication, he's got the two sons, like I said, Grant, who's Ravager, and Joseph, who's Jericho. Then they do reveal later he's got another daughter, and who goes on to become another version of Ravager, who's sometimes a good guy, sometimes a bad guy. I really like Rose, actually, his daughter, quite a bit. I think she's great. So physically, though, he's a lot like Captain America. I realized that when I was reading this. Other than the 90% of his brain capacity, he's very much like Captain America, actually. I'm assuming you're a fan of this character. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, sure. I read New Teen Titans. Yeah. For a character not superpowered, he really was able to hold his own, as you could see in the Serpent. He's punching Wonder Girl, for Pete's sake.
No, he's blasting her with the power staff.
He's blasting her. But, I mean, he's knocking her, you know. Like,
Yeah.
She's Wonder Woman, for Pete's sake. And he's just Batman, but he's still able to do it.
He's a great character. They've done a ton of stuff with him. I mean, some would say he's a little overexposed and it's become too much of like a big bad.
He was going to be the big bad in the next Justice League movie, but that never happened.
Yep. He showed up at the end. I mean, he
showed
in
up
it.
At the end. Yep. That's right.
For me, I like him when he's more of an anti-hero. I like when they give him a series and he's still a mercenary, but he's kind of trying to do the right thing. Like I like the 1990 series quite a bit. I like some of the New 52 series actually was pretty decent for a while there. So there's been a lot of Deathstroke series I enjoy. So anyway, first appearance goes back to New Teen Titans issue number 2. Of course, if you want more on him, you can listen to the Pop Culture Affidavit. You can listen to Titan of the Defense. You can watch a million different Teen Titans cartoons. He was on Smallville. He was on Arrow. He was on Titans. He was in the Justice League movie, as you just mentioned. He was in Young Justice. He was in Beware the Batman, DC Superhero Girls, My Adventures with Superman, animated DC movies, Lego movies, video games, including the Arkham franchise. So he is everywhere you might want to be. And that's why I think he's one of the most popular characters that DC's created in the last 50 years.
Okay.
All right.
Next up, I'm waiting for you to do the randomizer.
I'm really tired. Beep, boop, boop, boop. Kapow! That was dark. That was
really
dark.
It should be more blam, blam. Vigilante, not the Gore Tolton one, the Prairie Justice one, the Adrian Chase version, who first appeared in another New Teen Titans character, New Teen Titans Annual number 2. Here he is drawn by Todd Smith and Rick Magyar. Adrian Chase is a former lawyer, then turned judge, whose family is murdered by the mob, Punisher, and then decides to become a crusader for justice. And much like the Punisher, he brings a level of brutality that most DC characters do not, and that he is willing to kill people to bring justice to the world. And Vigilante immediately got his own series not long after that appearance. It was a Baxter series. It was like a direct-only series. I bought every single issue of that title. I loved it. And it got crazier and crazier as it went on, because eventually he gives up being Vigilante to be replaced by another guy who becomes Vigilante, and then he gets killed, and then a third guy takes over and becomes Vigilante, and then he gets killed by Peacemaker in during that run written by Paul Kupperberg. I can remember to this day buying that comic month to month, and I just could not wait to see what was going to happen next, because Kupperberg was just leaving nothing on the table. He was just going through, burning through ideas left and right. And then eventually Adrian Chase takes back over becoming the Vigilante. And then the book got canceled with number 50, which leads to Adrian Chase. It doesn't mention it here, but it leads to Adrian Chase killing himself. So pretty grim stuff as it goes. And of course, the Vigilante, as we mentioned in the top of the show, has now had a whole new life in as a side character in the Peacemaker TV series. So I love his uniform. I love his look, the goggles and the whole bit. Just cool stuff. So I've always dug this character. And you can see how much has gone on for a character that wasn't around that long at this point, because he gets 2 pages to himself.
I was going to ask about that. Did he really deserve 2 pages? Now, this is an issue 25 of Who's Who, by the way. So 1 issue from the end. Did he deserve 2 pages, or were they coming to the end and they're like, oh, we just got to make this?
I mean, you know, there's a lot of history there. I mean, I'm not sure at what point in the run. Let's see. They talk about the Peacemaker stuff, and that was around.
I can tell you. I already did. It's 11 months from now is when he kills himself.
Okay, so the book, yeah, all right, the book maybe was doing okay. I don't know at that point. I mean, after he was just a year away from being ending, from ending. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I mean, he did headline his own title for 4 years. It's not nothing. Yeah. So, you know, we see him ticking on the Electrocutioner. We see some of the origin stuff. The book was being drawn by Todd Smith. That's why he's doing it here, as opposed to George Perez, who designed the character. I like I said, I read every issue of Vigilante, and I had it for many years. So, you know, crazy character, but I dug it. And I love the look. The uniform is great.
Well, one of the things I like about it is it's all black. So when he's drawn in a comic book, like his chin is just gone. Like it just disappears into it because it's all black and inky. And I think that's a really neat look because you can still tell where the shapes of the body is, but it just it vanishes. So I think that's a cool look. As we said earlier, it's got to be hot and sweaty in there, though. I mean, there's not 1 inch of exposed skin.
No. Yeah.
Well, that whole suit is just water inside. Now, it's interesting thing. So he does kill himself in 11 months from here. And the shocking thing is in the comics, he's still dead. After all these years have passed, and they've done a million different Vigilante series and new versions of Vigilante, Adrian Chase is still dead, which is really impressive. Now, I never read this particular series, but I did dig – I mentioned that Deathstroke comic from the 90s. There was another, I think the third or fourth Vigilante at that point. A woman took the role of Vigilante, and she smartly kept the cowl off so her head could breathe. But anyway, so she ended up – her Deathstroke kind of became an item. She was like a supporting character in his book, and I really like that.
It mentions this group that kind of trains him. It's a small cult of men and women dedicated to battling the same evils which overwhelmed him in New York. And I love the names of the people. Chaka, Bloody Knife, and Chastity, which is just like – Chastity's kind of nice and gentle, kind of slightly hippie girl. Chaka's okay. And then Bloody Knife. You're like, wow, okay, you really went hard on that name there. But yeah, I say, you know, I mentioned Paul Kupperberg earlier. He's been posting kind of reminiscences of his Vigilante runs, and I've been having fun reading those posts on social media because I really, that book was just crazy. Like, you know, so many comic book series, you know, not that much is going to happen because they have to keep it consistent from month to month. The Vigilante, you just felt like he was just like writing it to the end and then figuring out what he was going to do the next month at that point. Like, oh, now what? You know, it had that kind of really loose quality. So I dug it. So yeah, it was cool. And you know, for this issue of Who's Who, he was the main character. He got like the main, he was the main figure on the cover.
You're right. You're right. It's a nice entry. It's pretty. And that shot of Peacemaker shooting, the other, Vigilante is pretty shocking. So yeah, no, it's a nice piece. Again, I do question if he deserved 2 pages, but whatever. It's nice. Right,
fair enough.
And that is our third. Oh, if you want more on him, you can check out the Pop Culture Affidavit, Titan of the Defense. He's on Arrow and that wonky, crazy version on Peacemaker.
It is truly, he is truly a complete psychopath on Peacemaker.
Yes. But he's not a former judge. He sweeps the floor at like a burger barn.
Yeah, so. No. It's a complete reinvention of the. He's named Adrian Chase, but it's a completely reinvent, complete reimagining of the character.
So, all right. Now, we still have to do Zooms Who, but before we do that, I always ask you for your favorite entries in the book. You're going to have to go first because I forgot to write mine down, so I'm doing that right now.
Okay. We always keep it to three, right? Or I always keep it to three?
I mean, we do whatever.
Okay. If I'm going to limit myself to three, oh, man. I mean, artwork-wise, there's so many good ones. I don't want to leave it at I'm going to judge it by other criteria, not just quality of artwork, because if it was quality of artwork, you'd have to throw in Jerry Ordway. But I'm going to go with Captain Storm because I just love the action shot, Green Lantern because it's a masterpiece, and I hate to not give it to George Perez, but I'm going to go with Queen Bee by Steve Dillon just because it's so unique.
Wow. Okay. All right. I'm going to go four. I don't care. It's your own rule for three. I don't have to follow.
I'm limiting myself as I normally do. Yes.
You're doing all things in your life. Terminator, Deathstroke. I got to give it to that. That's the best entry in the book, hands down. It's just astonishing. Then Alan Scott Green Lantern, which is, as we just raved about, is great.
That's the winner, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you know what? You're right. Green Lantern is better than the Deathstroke one. Green Lantern, Alan Scott is the winner. You're right.
There you go.
Then rather than going with Captain Storm, which I do like, I'm actually going to go with Captain Compass. That little shot that Gray Morrow did is just so great. I love it. It looks fantastic. And then I got to give it to Brainwave Jr. as my fourth.
Right. Right. There's so many ones of just pure fantastic artwork that I feel bad not giving it to Jerry Ordway. But he wins a lot when we do these. So
it's true.
You can set one out for the month.
He is extraordinary. So,
yep.
All right. Now it is time for Zoom's Who? Zoom and Isamu Yukinori's addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. And what has the randomizer given us this time, Rob?
It's given us the randomizer. Yes. Woo! The randomizer gets his own, not its own, not his, its own Who's Who listing. It first appeared in Who's Who Review number 1. So this is definitely the snake eating its own tail. Drawn by Jack Kirby and Michael Thibodeau. We've got Jack Kirby-esque drawings of me and David S. Gutierrez in the background there. We've got...
it's me and you.
It looks like David S. Gutierrez to me.
Well, I'm sure... I mean, Isamu had to have done this, right?
Yes,
I mean,
of course. Yeah. Yes.
And so that's got to be two... I assume those are two Jack Kirby characters that he just said, well, they look kind of like Robin
Shack. I think so, yes. Yeah. I believe so. I used that portrait of myself as my Facebook avatar for a while. I really enjoyed that. I love that the randomizer logo is made up of different letters. Perfect yes. for the randomizer. Yes. I love that it's harkening back to a toy talk that we had not that long ago. One of his cousins is the 2XL
yes.
from Mego. And R2-D2 is an inspirational ancestor. Again, Isamu, like his father, just does not miss. With a series of beeps and boops, Beep Boop, which is his real name, its real name, keep doing that, sorry, draws upon the randomized cosmic radiation with its own essence to select one or more items from a larger group at random. It has demonstrated the ability to select up to 13 random items from a group of 8-19, but the full range of its randomizer powers is yet to be determined. Again, just, you know, I know that over on Batman Family Reunion RIP, they used to feel bad about asking Isamu to do stuff. I don't feel that. I love that he did this. This is just absolutely fantastic. I wish the randomizer existed as a real thing. It's absolutely beautiful. And thank you, Isamu. You did a just marvelous job.
And to be clear, we didn't ask for this. We released the last episode of Who's Who, and suddenly, boom, he dumps this on us.
But by giving it its own time on the show, we might be encouraging Isamu to do these things, which I'm saying I have no guilt over.
Well, I... study for school, okay, buddy? That comes first. As a parent, I got to worry about, and your uncle, I got to worry about your grades first, then do our silliness. So earlier, I told you the Green Lantern entry. I said, pay attention. I read all that boring stuff about Guardians of the Universe. Isamu uses it here. What is the shocking coincidence that the verbiage from the Green Lantern entry is almost paralleled here? Ages ago, the Guardians of the Universe decided that in order to preserve the rule of the cosmos, they must remove what elements of chaos they could find. Thus, they gathered together most of the random cosmic radiation of the universe and contained it within a decommissioned power battery. So it's the same idea as the Star Heart. So that's amazing that happened that way. So we mentioned 2XL in previous episodes. We also mentioned the Simon. So both of those get mentioned there, as you said. Now, one thing I do take issue with here is it says base of operations is Rob's hometown.
Yeah, I'm a little no, offended. Not hometown. It's not hometown.
Well, where you live now? Where you
where
live
I
now.
Live now? Oxford, Florida.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm a little offended. It could have just.
Thanks, Isamu. Appreciate it, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So it's hilarious. Now I do like too that he's very carefully navigated Siskoid's persnicketiness because Siskoid, you know, took issue with us having the randomizer because he premiered the randomizer first in panel by panel, which is absolutely fair. And so Isamu has taken the time to explain that there's actually two different randomizers, Siskoid's randomizer and our randomizer. They're two completely different entities, which is hilarious. This will be on the gallery, folks, and it's absolutely worth reading. It looks just like a Jack Kirby drawing. It looks just like a Jack Kirby Who's Who entry, and it is so funny. It is so, I mean, obviously we love it because it's about us, but it is hilarious.
Siskoid's offense is a little rich considering he is now doing a Who's Who show as well.
Yeah, well,
long after we started.
Hot or Not was basically inspired by Who's Who.
I was gonna say, put that attitude neutral there, Siskoid. That's all. I can say that because I know he's not listening to this, so he's not gonna get offended.
Those Canadians, man, they're always trouble. Seriously. So,
Wonderful stuff. Just so it's so perfect, you know. It when it arrived, you just went, "Yeah, of course, of course."
So, thank you so much, Isamu. We absolutely love this. It is a joy. So, all right, remember, folks, go out to our gallery. You can see all these entries. But now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and we come back. We're going to cover your feedback in a segment we call "Who's Who, Hows, and Whys."
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Hey folks, I want to tell you about Magazines and Monsters, a podcast that's dedicated to comic books as well as classic horror and sci-fi films. This podcast channel contains a bunch of shows like the Bronze Age of Horror Comics, a podcast that's, well, it's about Bronze Age horror comics. There's also The Brave and the Bob, a show celebrating Volume 1 of The Brave and the Bold from DC Comics and all things Bob Haney. But hey, let's not forget the main show itself, Magazines and Monsters, which rotates between old-school horror and sci-fi films with a heavy emphasis on the British studios Hammer and Amicus. Plus, you'll get a selection of episodes about comic books ranging from DC to Marvel and everything in between. So join your host Billy D and a few of his favorite friends for a fun and positive look at his two favorite pastimes. Find Magazines and Monsters now on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back for Who's Who, Hows, and Whys. First off, we're going to talk about some iTunes reviews. As always, folks, I do ask if you haven't left a review yet, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. You can look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, which is a little long. If you just type Who's Who, you'll never find us because there's a million things. You can type in Who's Who Review. That'll find it really quickly. As a thank you, we'll read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air, just like this one from CyberStorm75, who writes, "Blast from the Past. I absolutely love this podcast. It takes me back to my childhood when I was discovering these characters for the first time. I love the enthusiasm and the excitement that Shag and Rob provide for these entries. Even the not-so-fun entries are interesting. I have binged many of the past episodes, and it's a joy each time to revisit a bygone era of DC Comics." Well, thank you, CyberStorm75. I appreciate that. Again, folks, look for Who's Who Review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Now, remember, folks, going into the rest of the feedback here, we pull your feedback from our website. So if you want your comments read on the web, read on the episode, you can either post on our website or email us. Those are the two ways to get this your feedback read. I'm going to start off with an email from Josh Romano. It says, "Hello, Robin Shag. I've been making my way through the original run of the Who's Who podcast, as well as the reviews. You guys do repeat things from time the first time, though, and Shag always seems to be hearing it for the first time, but it was over a decade ago." Yeah, that's absolutely my argument as well, Josh. It's been a long time, so I don't remember anything from yesterday either. So he goes, "Two things from recent listening. In the last review, Shag said the challenge of the Super Friends Bizarro has a redneck accent, and Rob disagreed. I have to agree with Shag. I hear it too." Woo, thank you, Josh. That is reaffirming to me, because it's always been, again, not as much as, like, you know, Solomon Grundy, like you said, Rob, but there's always just a hint of it there, and I'm glad I'm not the only one who heard it.
Should we get our resident redneck to weigh in on this?
He might, as we go through the feedback. I guess we'll find out.
Okay.
Then in the original run, Shag laments... what, did you really just call Chris a redneck? Wow.
He calls himself that.
No, he's country. There's a difference. As someone who lives in the South now, you need to learn there's a difference between country and redneck. But anyway.
I refuse to do that. And his favorite movie is Smokey and the Bandit. Okay? I'm like, what?
That's not redneck.
Here?
Anyway. In the original run, Shag laments several times about the lack of an Earth 1 Superman entry, and I totally agree. They could have labeled the Superman like Earth 1, Superman 1 from Earth 2, Superman 2 from Earth 1, and Superman 3 from Post-Crisis. Mike's Amazing World specifically identifies them as each as different characters, and that's good enough for me. And Batman did get an Earth 1 and an Earth 2 and a Post-Crisis entry in the update. But I also understand where it would get weird after a while. I started thinking about The Flash, for example. Following the same logic as Superman, you might end up with entries for, based on order of appearance, Flash 1, the pre-Crisis Earth 2 Jay Garrick. Flash 2, pre-Crisis Earth 1 Barry Allen. Flash 3, post-Crisis Jay Garrick. Flash 4, post-Crisis Barry Allen, who's already dead when post-Crisis continuity starts. Flash 5, post-Crisis Wally West. This goes on for a while. Since a crisis was supposed to make things clearer and easier, maybe it's best to just leave things alone. That's also the nerdiest thing I've thought about in a long time. Great work. Great show and great network. Thanks for all your work, guys. Well, thank you so much, Josh. I really appreciate it. And thanks for backing me up on Bizarro. Bizarro.
Yeah, okay. I'm imagining this issue of Who's Who that's like all Flash, right?
There's nothing
good Flash listings. Like, okay, this Flash and this and this one. Okay. So, okay, getting to the comments from the website. First up is the aforementioned our pal, Isamu Hideki Yukinori. He says, another fun show, gentlemen. No turkey tryptophan in my system. For had an almost completely vegan Thanksgiving. Good on you, Isamu. The mac and cheese doesn't count. There may have been some tryptophan and some of those nuts I ate, though. Okay. Regarding the dead man entry, an amazing entry. Praised be his name indeed. Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name.
Praise be his name.
did draw a few dead man stories in Adventure Comics before he illustrated the 86 miniseries, which was just beautiful. I forgot. You know what? I knew that and I forgot. Thank you, Isamu.
I don't remember this 86 miniseries existing. Huh, okay.
The 86? Really?
Yeah. Was that the reprints or was that something else?
No, it was an original miniseries.
It's not the Kelly Jones one either, right?
No, no. It's a four issue. I think Andy Helfer was the writer. But I'm saying I forgot that he, because I remembered Jose, I remember Deadman being in Adventure Comics. Yeah. I remember them only being drawn by Aparo, but that isn't correct. So thank you, Isamu. Yeah. Anyway, continues on. He says, the League of Assassins connection was indeed a retcon. In the Neil Adams stories, Dead Man's Killer was auditioning to join a society of assassins led by a mysterious Asian master called the Sensei, see Strange Adventures 215. After the League of Assassins debuted in Detective 405, writer Mike Friedrich made the same organization, Justice League of America number 94, where Merlin's comment to the Sensei referred to their League of Assassins. Dad planned to have Deadman appear in season 3 of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show. He was going to cover one of the Adventure Comics stories and planned to ask Ryan Daly to voice Boston Brand. He also had a clever idea for the voice effects when Boston possessed various members of the Zoom crew to interject in their review. Deadman was going to unwittingly provide an additional variable in the anti-life equation that Desaad was putting. I love that he puts the notations in his own comments. Was putting together that season, a dad wanted to have Deadman show up in the finale, where it would be revealed that him possessing either Terraman or Professor Zoom would protect them from the anti-life equation's effects. Sadly, he had to cut the Deadman episode and one other planned episode from the final season when he realized he didn't have enough time. Whew! My God, just that paragraph by itself, let alone the effort to put it together.
I mean, the continuity in the Done in One Wonders was very deep, deep continuity.
Needed its own Who's Who series. Right. Regarding Green Arrow 2, I suspect Adventure Comics 250 was decided as the Earth 1 version's first appearance because of the Silver Age origin story in Adventure 250. 6 was drawn by Kirby, so the researcher, in addition, went back to where Green Arrow first had that distinctive Kirby look. Right? Argument with the there, Isamu.
He chimes in and says, because we talked about Stalker last time. We talked about how he's like a D&D character, basically. And Isamu says, say, wasn't the Stalker involved in the JSA Returns event in the 1990s? Let me tell you, that was a giant slap in the face to me, like, or I should have had a V8 moment or whatever, when I totally missed, and to this day, I still don't really put the connection together, that, yeah, the JSA Returns miniseries in 1999, which I'm going to be talking about very soon on the JSA podcast, Stalker was the main villain, but he was so different that I completely never realized it was the same Stalker. And there are a few other people I'm going to mention as we go. So thank you, Isamu, for opening my eyes to that shocking fact.
Good pull. And then finally, he mentions the terrific What's It, which was the Zoom's Who listing from the previous episode. Dad did indeed write this entry. I don't suppose it's a spoiler to reveal that Mom will be drawing the entry for Hoppy the Marvel Bunny, a funny animal version of Captain Marvel who predated the terrific What's It by almost 2 years in Zoom's Who Volume 3. Oh, I'm so excited. McSnurtle Turtle. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I speculated that when we did that, the terrific What's It was the fastest turnaround of a character to a anthropomorphic animal parody. And obviously, Marvel Bunny.
Hoppy the Marvel Bunny. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
McSnurtle the Turtle was Iris West's childhood stuffed animal in CW's The Flash television series. What a pull. What a pull for the TV show. I am so excited there's going to be volume 3 of this Zoom.
Yes.
Show. I have the two copies sitting on my spinner rack here. Oh, I'm so excited.
They sit with my Who's Who, is where they sit in line.
Yeah, right
on a bookshelf. Yep. Siskoid from the Firewater Podcast Network, he has shows such as Who's Editing, or Hot More, or Not More. He responded to some of the comments that Isamu had made, basically saying, yeah, because they had talked about the editing issues in some of these stories. And he said, in defense of Brenda Pope, one, checking information is an editor's job, not hers. And two, the info was up. This is talking about the Bizarro entry. The info is up to date. He was Yellow Lantern in DC Comics Presents number 71, because I had said he was Yellow Candle. So there we go. Good catch, Siskoid. All right. Then up next is Kevin Miller, who wrote us an email. And Kevin, by the way, Kevin Miller is a writer of a lot of books, including the Game On series with the Big Twitch, the Stream Team, and the Battle of the Bots, and a lot more. Kevin says, I was very late to the party regarding the Who's Who podcast and subsequent series, but I've been on an avid listener ever since I discovered it earlier this year while doing research for a book about Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is coming out July 29th from Tomorrow's Publishing. I tend to listen to it at 1.5 speed while working out, driving, cleaning our short-term rental suite, or doing anything else that allows me the time and mental space to absorb the material. It's since become one of my favorite podcasts. Oh, well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that. He says, I also get a kick out of the many playful, derogatory mentions of Shag and other comics-related podcasts I listen to. Almost no one I know cares about comics, so podcasts like yours make me feel like I'm part of a much broader community. All that to say, thanks for pouring your heart, soul, and sense of humor into the series. Every episode is a blast. Well, thank you, Kevin. We really appreciate that.
That's fantastic. Edo Boznar says, well, color me impressed. Shag has enough digits, and I'm assuming other appendages, on his body to count to over 800. That's worth its own Who's Who entry. Great show as usual. Another interesting set of entries, and I agree with everyone's picks for favorites. And yes, the terrific What's It entry is gorgeous. On Colonel Computron, I have to note that I have absolutely no memory of this character, despite having had back then the issue in which he first appeared, i.e. Flash 304. The reason he didn't make an impression is probably there was something mentioned by Shag, and then it was the last issue in which Firestorm backup appeared. At the time, I was pretty much only picking up Flash for those backups, and we continued to do so for the Dr. Fate backups that began soon afterward, while just skimming through the main story. I really wasn't a big fan of Infantino's second tenure on that title.
I'm right there with you, Ido. I bought all those Flash issues for the Firestorm backups myself. For many years, I didn't read the front stories. Eventually, I did get around to reading a lot of them. Colonel Computron was one of the ones I read. But yeah, for me, it was the backup stories of Firestorm and Dr. Fate that kept me coming back. All right, then we're from Ryan Daly from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as Cheers Cast, Batman Nightcast, and more. He says, because we talked about Green Arrow and the backup strips there and Onyx last time. He says, listener of Cheers Cast may be surprised to learn I once had an interest in Black Canary. So much so, in fact, that I blogged about her. I covered the Green Arrow backup strips in Detective Comics that featured Onyx. I always thought that she was a really cool looking character with a lot of potential. At least I think that's what I thought. Honestly, I barely remember the story or those comics or that blog or that time in my life. That's what happens when you have a kid, Ryan. It all just goes. All the memory just goes.
Steve Givens from the JLA Stories and Friends podcast says, at the Baltimore Comic Con back in October, I was lucky enough to get both JLGL, PBHN, and Mike Grell to sign the Dead Man and Green Arrow entries in my Who's Who omnibus. Both are standouts in the whole series, so I knew I had to get them signed by their respective artists. Very cool. Dig that.
Nice. We had a great time at the Baltimore Comic Con. It was great to see Steve and hang out. Then we got a message from Jeremy Ciccone. He says, okay, I've been trying to sit on this until we hear the Who's Who Legion of Superheroes episodes, and I almost let it go when Rob said that Mentala's update entry changed his mind slightly on the Legion. But I keep coming back to it, so here goes. Saying that Tellus is the sort of character that makes you despise the Legion is, quite frankly, upsetting to say the least. To my mind, when Tellus was introduced, he represented the promise of the Legion that had not been fulfilled up to that point and still remains untouched today, to be the 30th/31st century replacement for the Green Lantern Corps. Up until that point, the Legion had been mostly white guys and girls with the occasional Caucasian analog of some other color thrown in. Sure, we had Tyrock and eventually Invisible Kid too, but still, Tellus, Quizlet, and later Gates started us on a path of filling the gap left by the Green Lantern Corps of non-humanoids that says the galaxy is more than what southern white guys who don't read comics think it is, and we need to show that. But what we really need is to see more if the Legion is ever allowed to be reborn. And then he says, OG retro boot all the way. Long live the Legion and keep up the good work. And just finished the Loose Leaf issue number 9 episode. Still loving the show. And for Shag, here is a custom action figure for Kent Shakespeare. So he shared this with us. It is an amazing Kent Shakespeare action figure custom. It looks amazing. I love it so much because Kent Shakespeare is near and dear to my heart. I've always loved that more so that the concept of that character than what they actually did with him. But I love the idea of him being sort of a stand-in for Superboy in the Legion. So, yay, Ken Shakespeare.
It's great work. I think I commented this on the last episode or the one before that. But, like, yeah, I realized that I was – having not really read the Legion very much, I had a view of the Legion that is not accurate. I always thought of them as, like, futuristic JLA. And so, therefore, they're, like, the cream of the crop. But that isn't right, of course. That's not their mission. That's not the whole gestalt of that title. So it makes sense that you would have other alien life forms. So it's not fair to compare them the way I would to say the Justice League. So my criticism of having Telus in the JLA, in the Legion, is incorrect based on faulty premise of how I view both teams. So I cop to that one.
I love watching you backpedal. It's great.
Hey, you know, I'm man enough to admit when I was wrong about something. I can only go by how I felt at the time, right? I can recall at the time being like, who the hell is this guy? Is a member of the Legion? You know, but I realize it's a different thing.
I'll say in Rob's defense also, when we're recording these shows, you know, we're trying to condense 14 characters into a short recording time. Our job is to be entertaining, not be a Wikipedia. So sometimes we say something we may not necessarily agree with, and it just made sense at that moment. That happens too.
That is absolutely happens a lot. So yeah. So okay, let's move on. Michael Bailey from the Bailey Planet website. It all comes back to Superman podcast and many, many more. Says the League of Challenger Haters gives off the same energy as someone who just picks an obscure character to blog or podcast about. No, that's not meant as an insult. I just see something similar between not going up against the JLA and picking a lesser known character to explore. Maybe that's just me. I do like the idea of them being kind of like podcasters and stuff, because the League of Challenger Haters is just like the worst name in the history of the universe.
I'm just saying, Mike, I feel targeted. Okay. I just want to say that.
Both of us.
All right.
Really.
So, right. Yeah. Then I mean, Aquaman, goodness gracious. Then he goes on to say Green Arrow. There is now a generation of DC fans that think that Oliver Queen is one of the most important characters in the pantheon. The CW was not always perfect or good, but it was great at batting. I'm sorry. Had a great batting average and swung for the fences in a way that the movie series running at the same time didn't. Part of me will always be amused by the fact that Arrow started as this Nolan-esque version of Oliver Queen with no flight, no tights, and no superpowers. And by the end, Oliver Queen is the Spectre. That is quite the arc. Quite the arc. Wild, even. I love it, Mike. Absolutely love it. Then we'll hear from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He writes his own fanfic all about the character of Onyx. I don't know if I suggested people write fanfic for about Onyx or not. It sounds like something I would say. But I love that you took the time to do this, Bucky. Folks, you can find all that on our website, firewaterpodcast.com. Bucky, again, wrote fanfic for Onyx. That is fantastic.
Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Books Commentary, and the Legion of Super Bloggers, and currently of the effort to get him invited by James Gunn to the Supergirl movie premiere. Let's try and get this going, everyone. The Fire and Water Podcast Network makes things happen. So let's use our power to get Dr. Ange to the Supergirl premiere, everybody, out in Los Angeles in like June or whatever that is. Let's make it happen. He mentions a fun episode as always, Onyx. This image lives in my dreams. She looks so boss. Jerome K. Moore could do no wrong. Never read a single issue she's in.
Well, that was me too. Like the image was so striking that it stays with me. It looks amazing.
Great stuff. Great stuff. Movie Matt Sorois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast says, thanks for another great episode, gentlemen. While the challenge of the Super Friends Bizarro did make me think he was a redneck, he did give me
clarify. You sort of stumbled over your words. He says, did not make me think he
I
was a
I thought I
redneck.
Said that. Didn't make me
well,
think
you did,
he was
but you
a redneck.
Kind of, yeah.
All right. Okay. He did give me the impression that Bizarro was outright evil as opposed to a goofball that causes destruction just trying to be the worst he can be. Does anyone else think Onyx wants to lead a glamorous life? I could totally see her hanging out with Sheila E., Apollonia, and Prince, taking shelter under the graffiti bridge to avoid the purple rain.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, 100%.
Does have that vibe. And then move on. Chris Franklin, of course, from this network, the aforementioned redneck, host of the recently wrapped up JLU cast, plus Batman Nightcast, and another show coming soon. Won't reveal what else that is, but it's really exciting. Bizarro on Challenge of the Super Friends, oddly, was voiced by Bill Calloway, the voice of Aquaman, starting with that series. I never got redneck, but I agree with Matt Sorois. He did seem more threatening and just evil on Challenge. later episodes, like the superpowers appearance, played him goofy, and he was more appropriately voiced by Superman voice actor Danny Dark. But as Rob said, Solomon Grundy had that great exaggerated Southern Cajun voice, which I tried to mimic on The House of Frankenstein, but some folks think I sound like Mr. T.
Oh my gosh. Drink your milk, eat your greens.
We're going to defeat the Super Friends. DC Dave from the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast, says, ever since All-Star Squadron number 60 was published and Green Arrow and Speedy are in that group shot, I have that same isn't this problematic thought that you've had.
All right. Then we hear from Martin Gray from Too Dangerous for a Girl blog. It says, cheers for another top episode, Bat Cousins, Rob and Shag. My favorite entry this time is The Bizarro World, The Privateer, and Dead Man. Those are some good ones, Martin. It says, that Green Arrow logo is awful. It has no impact and looks amateurish, which is some going as it was designed by the great Gaspar Saldino. The angles of the italics on the G in green and the A in arrow don't match, and the W isn't italicized at all. Martin, I got to say, I don't necessarily agree with you. I love that logo. I think it's fantastic. I'm sorry it wasn't for you. I can understand on some of the structural design issues you might have, but I don't care. The heart wants what the heart wants, and I love it. He says, I would say the Green Arrow backups and Detective are worth reading. There were an especially well-regarded two-parter, The Night Olympics by Alan Moore and Klaus Janson. As for Onyx, she's yet another one who trained in a monastery. Are all monasteries in the DC Universe actually fight clubs? Are they situated next door to Wildcat's gym? Yes, Martin, you've stumbled onto the secret truth of the DC comic universe is that every monastery is secretly a fight club, and that's the only thing that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Tim Price from Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast, says, another delightful episode, gents. The randomizer never makes for a boring lineup. Regarding Kanjar Rowe, one of his stories was in the JLA Treasury Edition, and it was a mind-bender of creating duplicate Leaguers and even a dupe of the planet Earth. Man, the 60s. Maybe I missed a mention that Kanjar was a recurring character in Hawkworld, but as a toady government administrative type. It's not a bad use for the character, but undercuts how ridiculously powerful he had been.
Yeah, he was a very much a recurring character in Hawkworld. I can't believe I didn't talk about that. But yeah, so... And maybe that's part of the reason I think he's a bit of a joke, because he was just like a government toady there. Hmm. All right. Then we're from Brett Young for the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He is our show Fantastic Poor, and he's our 24-hour tech support for our Fire & Water Only fans page. he says, just want to say I love the show as always, and JLGL killed it with the Dead Man art, one of the Who's Who's best entries. My hot take is that Mike Grell's Green Arrow is way overrated. Green Arrow is on my DC Mount Rushmore of heroes, but I could never get into the Grell interpretation of him. The art always seemed amateurish, not trying to be a jerk. I love Grell's art on the Legion, but Green Arrow work just didn't do it for me. So here's the interesting thing, Rob, is that Brett just shared this feedback with me today. Just today I got this. And if he had shared this last year, about the time this episode came out, or maybe even a little bit early in October when we went to the Baltimore Comic Con, he actually sat down at a dinner table with Darren and Ruth Sutherland. They probably would have killed him.
Oh, I mean, my right God. There, yeah, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that's
they would have just executed him right there, and we all would have been witnesses. They probably had to kill all of us, too, honestly, just to get to clean up the loose ends.
They are paid assassins. They're in retirement, exactly. But they are paid. They are ex-paid assassins. So, yeah,
I mean, that's what I was going with, yeah. and then last comment from Brett Young. He shows that there is a modicum of intelligence in that head, and he says, yes, the Super Friends Bizarro does talk like a hayseed. See? So that's two of us, or three, really, if you count myself, that all feel like there's a little bit of a country redneck kind of going on there.
Okay.
All right. Then Kevin from New Orleans says, why would DC turn down any Alan Moore pitch? I was mad when I found out about the Martian Manhunter story that he wanted to write, and now I learned about a Bizarro World idea he had. I'm mad again.
Yeah, right, it makes no sense, right? Alan Moore was like the hottest of the hot at that point. You think he would just, yeah, fine, do it.
Exactly. They were from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. He mentioned Multi-Man. This is the base of operations is it's a bunch of long letters together, but if you say it out loud, it's all over the place is where he's from. This guy was a joke even before the JLI, wasn't he? I think maybe he was, Mark.
That costume really, really got you there. So Noah Tarnell, from the Big Quiz thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast, says, another great episode. I agree that the Bizarro and Challenge of the Super Friends was far more menacing than the one goofing around on the square planet. He actually frightened me somewhat when I was a kid. For a similar take in the comics, read DC Special number 6 from 1977. He joins Grodd's incarnation of the Secret Society of Supervillains, and he's pretty badass. As someone who thought the joke of the goofy Bizarro got old really fast, I prefer him more threatening. I hope Paul Kinn is going to get to that in a DC special cast at some point.
Awesome. Then Noah goes on to say, I could be wrong, but I think I read that in current or recent DC continuity, we sort of got more Golden Age Speedy with the present-day Archer duo traveling back in time to join the Seven Soldiers of Victory, or am I fanficking in my dreams again? Hal follows up and says, you're right. Green Arrow and Speedy did travel back in time and spent quite a while in the Golden Age. This was courtesy of Geoff Johns. I'm not sure if he was picking up on that photograph in the All-Star Squadron, which DC Dave mentioned, but it wouldn't surprise me since it was a bit of a continuity buff, but not to the same extent as Roy Thomas. Now, I feel guilty that I did not mention that last episode. I should have totally, because Sean Ross and I did a whole episode about the Stargirl Spring Break special, which does reveal that, yes, Ollie and Speedy, in the early days of their career, ended up in a caper that threw them back in time to the 1940s, and they stayed there for either months or years. So they're saying the Golden Age, Green Arrow, and Speedy stories with the Seven Soldiers of Victory actually still happened, and that it was Oliver and Speedy in their youth, or the early days of their career, until then they were transported back to the future. Which is sort of funny because that's exactly what they did with Hippolyta and Wonder Woman, which we just talked about on JSA Presents recently. And so I find it interesting that both Oliver Queen and Hippolyta went back in time for modern day. So like we would crack jokes. Like I can imagine Hippolyta and Ollie hanging out, you know, like in the 1940s, being like, "Hey, what's the name of that thing? I don't know. Why don't you Google it?" Oh, we can't. You know, something like that. Anyway, then back to Noah Tarnow. He says, Stalker was indeed the primary villain of the Return of the JSA story from the 1990s that led into Robinson's new JSA Monthly. I assume he was essentially the same dude, but maybe I'm mistaken. No, you're right. And again, I'm shocked I never picked up on this, that Stalker from JSA Returns is the same Stalker from I just totally missed that, and I'm just embarrassed. So thank you to everyone who's bringing it up. And I don't mean that sarcastically. I'm serious. Then we're from Super Captain, says, I love Kanjar Rho. There's just something about those bug eyes, the gamma metal gong, and the space boat and the energy rod. You just don't get villains like that nowadays. And they never ruined him by trying to make him more menacing and threatening a la Despero. No, you're right, Super Captain. They made him boring by making him like a middle management and government agency. But still, those eyes are super creepy and weird.
Chris Mort says, Dead Man is my favorite piece of the selections this month. I love the character, so I might be biased. Besides not being able to see around his collar, does that thing just collect water in the rain or what?
Then Chris Mort says, finally, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm in a world where it feels like no one listens to one another. You guys truly listen to me. I started my No More Morts crusade in jest and never expected anything. But to hear Rob try so hard not to use the word really filled my heart with glee. I even told my 80-year-old father about this a while things, and he thought it was great. His comment was, score one for the Morts. Just another reason you guys and the Firewater Network are absolute best community in the podcasting world. You guys actually care about your listeners. Again, thank you for your courtesy and keep up the great work. Well, Chris, I just want you to know, there were two times this episode where I was going to refer to one of the characters by that term, and I stopped myself, all out of my effort to support you, buddy. It's not a promise that I won't ever say that word again in reference to a loser, but we're doing our best, at least on Who's Who for you, pal.
Yeah, absolutely. This is meant to be a fun experience for all the people that are listening. I don't want to make it upsetting, even if, you know.
it's his name, even if you are a Mort.
I'm sorry. It's just Wizard, you know. It's not my fault. But anyway, no. We want the show to be fun to listen to, and I don't ever want anyone to feel uncomfortable. It's a comic book podcast, for Pete's sakes. So next up is Diablo Frank from the...
Wait a minute. I got an idea. Instead of saying the M word, why don't we call something a Diablo Frank from now on when they're a loser? Wow, really? Nothing?
Diablo.
I just spent 8 hours with Frank in person. We had a great day. Me and Diablo Frank and AJ from the Right On Network spent a whole day together and had an absolute blast. So I can pick on him. He's a good friend.
Oh, you go right ahead. Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network, DC Secret Files and Origins Podcast, and more says, have you ever heard the Dorothy Parker quote, you can lead a whore to culture, but you can't make her think? The Kung entry reminded me of, yes, I have. Frank. The Kung entry reminded me of the time I sent Shag all four volumes of the non-powered Diana Prince trades that featured Dr. Cyber's earliest appearances nearly a decade ago, and yet the Wonder Woman Rogues Gallery slander remains a who's who constant. I just left a proper who's who screed in the monitor tape's comments in hopes of having better luck correcting their faulty impression of the amazing Amazon than you with your old dogs, or would Jane, your ignorant slut, be more apropos in this analogy? Admittedly, it was Rob bringing the heat, and the less said about the Aquaman Rogues Gallery is two less things said. There's just the two rogues. Is there a minimum number of rogues to form a gallery? Because I'm pretty sure it's more than two. Cheetah and Giganta were on Super Friends, which is twice as many villains as Aquaman got there, or anywhere, actually. The human flying fish shrine guy might want to sit this argument out.
My gosh, that was brilliant.
I've always acknowledged that Aquaman's Rogues Gallery was thin. I've never been like, Aquaman's okay. No, Aquaman's is thin as well. I'm just saying Wonder Woman's is, but you know, okay. She's had her villains in live action now. And as you say, two villains on the Super Friends. So, okay. They're point made, Frank.
Regardless, that was one of the better paragraphs Frank has written. That was hilarious.
I did enjoy that. Yes.
And he says, you know who would have been a good foe for the Emerald Archer? The Privateer, or really any Mark Shaw identity. Makes a lot of sense in that capacity. It makes more sense in that capacity than a Superman villain who unseats Talia in the Shadow Society of Assassins League LLC, or whatever the hell Event Leviathan was supposed to be. Again, cursed knowledge from who's editing the research. Yeah, you're right. Mark Shaw would have been great as an opponent of Green Arrow. That's a fantastic point, Frank. Yeah, I really like that. Perfect. Then Liz Oswald. Now, last time we were talking about the Trigger Twins, all right? And I was trying to remember a show about a pair of twins doing something. Well, Liz Ann Oswald comes to the rescue. She says, I'll say more later, but for now, the show Shag was thinking of was the Patty Duke Show. Yes, it was, yes. Liz. Thank you so much. That's what I was trying to come up with. I wasn't even on cold medicine that time. Yeah. So there we go.
They look alike. They sound alike. They yada, yada, yada. That's what
exactly.
The show is. So.
That's the Trigger Twins.
Yep. Captain Entropy says, great fun as always, gents. JLGL, PBA, Jen. And Mike Grell rocked the assignment, but Jerome K. Moore and Namiko Hideki Yukinori knocked it out of the park. Zoom 2 with that entry text. Finally, thank you very much for all the things the Fire and Water Network does for me. Never think I don't appreciate it. And if you only do it because you're a fan of my wife, then I applaud your judgment and taste. She loved the mention, by the way. Very flattered. Absolutely.
Mrs. Neg Entropy is absolutely wonderful. She is fantastic.
She sure is. Absolutely.
She's awesome. All right, the order from Bradley Glenn. It says, Shag, while discussing future... I was making a joke about the future 2026 and 2027. It says, while discussing the future 2026 and 2027 dates at the 2:21 of the episode, you mentioned the Lee Majors film where he drove a car across the country. That movie is one of my guilty pleasures. The Last Chase from 1981... Another notable guest star is Burgess Meredith, and it was set in the far, far future of 2011. That's insane. I made a reference to The Last Chase because I was speculating that 2027 is the year it took place. Obviously, I'm wrong, Bradley. Thank you. I remember watching that movie on cable over and over and over. In fact, every time I see an abandoned gas station that's a shutdown, I always think of Lee Majors going there and cutting open the thing and getting the gas. Anyway, I didn't know the name of the film. All these years, I've never known the name of it. So thank you. You've made me happy, and I want to seek that out now. Then we have Mike Thomas. This is a great episode, gentlemen. I agree with all of those who say the evil version of Bizarro from Challenge of the Super Friends was cooler than the more comic accurate version. His voice was scary. The only weakness of this Bizarro was that he could not punch his way out of a plastic bag from Batman's utility belt. That is fantastic. Those Challenge of the Super Friends bring so much joy. But yeah, everyone saw they'd be like, really? He's stuck in a vat? Okay. Then we're from Joe X. This is Onyx made it to the Young Justice cartoon, mostly due to Jerome K. Moore working on it. Look at that. That's awesome. Then we're from Mike Atchison from Mike's Comics Roadshow. He says, it's not often I get called out as an SME in a comic discussion. But yes, everyone should be uncomfortable with the idea of superheroes confining their prisoners, super or not, without some sort of due process and oversight by a third party. As you may recall, folks, we called on Mike Atchison's expertise as he worked in the prison system for years, and we were talking about the challenges of Challengers Mountain, where the Challengers of the Unknown were keeping their own prisoners. He says, I'm not sure what it would look like, but I can guarantee it would be a boring as hell to a reader. Oh, talking about the correct things for a prison. There would be some allowance for immediate and extraordinary methods of confinement based on the subject's threat level and power set. But again, we can't think too hard on it or distract from the fun of the story. What most prisons, jails, and other confinement settings must comply with, or at least for accreditation, are the standards set by the American Correctional Association. Read through a few of those standards, and while you immediately understand their importance and why they should not be taken for granted, you will likely doze off very quickly. Although, maybe it would be interesting to read a story of Belle Reeve failing an ACA audit when they discover the bombs on their wrists, or worse, in their heads, of the members of the Suicide Squad. Mike, thank you so much for bringing your expertise. I really appreciate that.
Civil rights lawyers are really highly, very, very busy in the DC universe. He says,
by the way, I want to throw in one more thing. Because we're recording this tonight, I'm missing dinner with Mike Atchison. I could have had dinner with Mike Atchison tonight, but we had to record this stupid show.
Wow. Stupid. Okay.
Sorry. Right. Maybe it's not stupid. I just want to hang out with my friend Mike.
That thing that you've all been listening to for the last 2.5 hours, Chegg thinks is stupid.
It is not stupid. I just want to hang out with my friend Mike. That's all.
Okay. What has bugged... Wow, man.
Wow, you really made this like a moment. It wasn't supposed to be a moment. But
well, you said it. What do you want me to do?
As Mike, we've established, we sometimes say weird things after recording for hours.
Yeah, Mike continues, what has bugged me for decades in the arena of prisons for villains is that they let them wear their costumes in prison. Granted, it simplifies the storytelling, but it still bugged me. I pointed this out in the comment section of DC Special Cast, because they've been covering the calculator stories, where I was imagining that, like, the calculator, right, he's laying in the cell and, like, he wakes up and, like, his chest calculator always has the word boobs written on it because different guys are touching the touchpad. Paul King kind of poo-pooed me because he thought it was lowbrow humor, which it was, but I thought I can bring it up here on my own show. So screw you, Paul. How about that?
Oh, I'm not allowed to call the show stupid, but you can call a fellow member of our network. You can say screw him. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's how it's two different things. Sure.
That's how it is here. Okay. Michael Kiroscuro says, another spectacular episode, gents. I was irrationally happy that the randomizer gifted us with Onyx this time. Christmas came early. I read all of her appearances back when those issues of Detective were coming out, and I was just in awe of Jerome K. Moore's art. Then I bought the issue of Who's Who with her, and I was instantly became one of my top five entries of the series, thanks in part to my fondness for those Green Arrow backups, but thanks largely to Moore's absolutely stunning Who's Who entry. Now that is how you draw a character standing still, yet still make them look dynamic, more dynamic than most characters look in action poses. She looks so badass, and to quote Shag, so hot. The portrait of the serpent is gorgeous as well. I know the costume is a little extra, but when Moore draws Onyx in it, the costume looks positively iconic. You're absolutely right, Michael. Then we heard from Sean Ross from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has a show called Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. He says, great episode, guys. The Colonel Comitron entry always bugged me because of the floating heads at the top. The one on the far right looks like Mama Cass, so I guess Colonel Comitron could be defeated with a dry ham sandwich.
That's mean, Sean. Jeez.
Then we heard from Jeff Tischer, who had lots to comment. Jeff always gives us, like, whatever happened to characters. And so he's got a lot of stuff out here, but I'll just read a few of them. Bizarro Yellow Lantern is in the Sinestro Corps as a member for Sector 1284 now, which is fun because aren't we Sector, 8214 or whatever? Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah, so it's mixed up the numbers. That's clever. Colonel Computron, Basil was last seen trying to hack into his former employer's accounts to rob them. He was stopped by Sugar and Spike, private investigators. We must have covered this on the Legends of Tomorrow comics that you and I did, Rob. I don't even remember doing
it. I'm
sure
we did, yeah, because we love those backups. Yep. Yeah.
Because they beat the Flash to the punch, hey-o, they have become the go-to for the superhero community when something embarrassing needs to be disposed of discreetly, like multicolored costumes when you primarily wear blue or gray, or a marriage certificate from when you almost married a monster, or you made an island in your own image. I don't remember Colonel Computron being in those, but those Sugar and Spike backups were excellent. They're so good.
Yeah, they were.
Then he says about Kung, the original Kung, Tommy Morita, died in the bombing of Hiroshima after he was convinced by the Americans to end the war and was traveling to see Emperor Hirohito. I can't say that.
Hirohito.
Thank you. It's the cold medicine. Where he's traveling to see the Emperor to accept surrender. Engaged by the Americans for not giving him time to end the war, his spirit attempted to gain revenge against the Justice Society, finally playing out in 2009. As a result, his soul was destroyed by the Spectre. It was also revealed that he was part of a mission of Vandal Savage on Dinosaur Island in 1927, fighting against Enemy Ace, Batlash, and Biff Bradley, the 1998 Guns of the Dragon miniseries by Tim Truman. Wow! I had no idea Kung had that kind of life. So that's fascinating. Thank you so much. And he says, side note, comic writer Stephanie Williams told me at two different cons that she desperately wants to write a Justice League Antarctica miniseries. She's done amazing work on Nubia, and she wrote the fantastic book Strange and Unsung All-Stars of the DC Multiverse in 2023. So let's put it out there and make it happen. Yes, Stephanie Williams, please, please write us a Justice League Antarctica series. That would make me very happy. And then last comment here, JLT says, I thought the beeps and boops were based on the old Jeopardy sound effect. To be fair, JLT, we do tend to lean into it, especially to the end. We tend to be like, boop, boop, boop. We tend to do the Jeopardy sound effect. I don't think that was ever intentional, but we kind of landed there, I think. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
All right, folks, this is the part of the show where we thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline. So we're talking about Facebook, Blue Sky. Theoretically, we'd be talking about Instagram, but man, it's being a real pain in my butt trying to see who's doing the reshares on Instagram. So if I missed you, I am terribly sorry. I know this sounds like a long list of names, like a really weird phone book, but we want to be sure to recognize every single person to help promote the show, because every single one of these folks are important. Wow. It is all the cold medicine is worn off, my friends. It is an important part. Oh my God. The Who's Who community. Wow. So thank you to everyone who shared us, including A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Boyce Jr., Bailey Planet, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer, Billy D., Black Vulcan 69, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Chris A. Field from Otherverse Games, Chris Franklin, Chris Mort, Codex Omniversa, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dave's Comics Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Retro Cabal, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Isamu Hideki Yukinori, John Stibe, Julia Rawl, Justice Trek, Keechee Baker,
Lizanne Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Sorois, Max Romero, Mike Jameson, Mike Thomas, Miracle Man at Komoda 1977, Monitor Earth Prime, Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers Podcast, Paul Kien, Phil at Paper Mache, Pop Culture Basement, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Retro for Life, Ryan Daly, Scott X, Sean Ross, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Steve Givens, Symbol Pending, The Hartley Show, The Monitor Tapes Podcast, Tim Price, and Zeb Oswald.
Woof! All right. Well, thank you, all of you, so much. Big round of applause. You guys are the best. Thank you for helping spread the word of the show. We sincerely appreciate it. And you can be on this list next time. All you got to do is share it on Facebook, Blue Sky, or Instagram. So thank you. Well, Rob, our next show is going to be in May, so it's not that far away. May 2026. I'm looking forward to it.
Isamu, get your entries in, buddy.
Oh, gosh, no. Don't.
I'm kidding. I'm not really kidding. No, I'm kidding, of course. We have lots of other entries we could pull. We had one all lined up, and then you got the randomizer sending in, and we had to do that one ahead of it. So we got lots more entries to cover. Don't, Isamu, yeah, do work on your studies, young man.
Do your poetry final exam first, please. Okay.
Exactly.
So, all right. With that, until next time, who's next?
Next.
Just awful. Just awful.
It's an important part of the show.
Oh!
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of a DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woolly Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
When I find out someone murdered an innocent person, or sold somebody heroin, or did some graffiti, and I kill that person with my bare hands, their eyeballs popping out of their skulls, you think that gives me pleasure?
No.
Well, it does.